Weekend Confirmed is brought to you by Game Center, the must-have app for gamers. Game Center is filled with game information, the latest gaming news from ShackNews.com, and videos and screenshots for over 7,000 games. Game Center is free and available now for the iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Weekend confirmed.
Ignition. Liftoff. Liftoff.
Welcome to Weekend Confirmed, everybody. My name is Garnet Lee. Thanks for joining us again on this show number one of year number two.
Hey.
It's kind of awesome, isn't it?
It is.
It's a new beginning.
It's a whole new beginning. Awesome cast for you today with the two Jeffs, Jeff Cannata.
Hey, how you doing? This show is actually going to be in 3D.
Is it?
Yeah.
How are we doing that?
Special technology.
Awesome.
Glassesless.
I hope it doesn't give me a headache.
It probably will.
Yeah.
And that's Mr. Jeff Mattis there.
Konnichiwa.
Wow.
That's my Shogun 2 time show.
Obviously.
Yeah.
You can't rule Japan, but you can pick up a quick intro.
How do you say I surrender in Japanese? Did you learn that one?
No. I just normally die.
They haven't given him time to learn it.
Yeah.
And good friend of the show, Mr. Christian Spicer, helping us kick off this second year.
Bringing the S to the 3D. Nice.
Or as we like to call him, Douche Crumpet.
As I love being called Douche Crumpet. Someone remix.
DC in the house.
Before we get too far afield, let me put this out there real quickly. As you guys heard, of course, and impossible to get away from, the unfolding events in Japan continue to be pretty grim, especially north of Tokyo. And a number of members of the media have come together for a initiative to do charitable auctions to raise money for the Red Cross relief efforts. And you can catch up with those at playforjapan.org. And it's exactly like it sounds. We're not using numbers. We're not lead speaking. It's play, F-O-R, Japan. Among those would be a Weekend Confirmed auction. If you've always wanted to check out the show here, we have put up for auction an opportunity to come to the studio here in Santa Monica and sit in the booth with the lovely Brooklyn, the fantastic Del Rio, and whomever else might be here. Actually, just the walls, I guess. Oh, Ryan will be here. You probably get filmed. We'll hang out during the pre-show. Someone asked, do you get to be on the show? I don't know. We haven't figured that out. That's difficult.
Well, you can make it a
maybe a segment or something. We'll figure something out. How about this? If you have the winning bid, we're going to make sure you have a great time, because the whole idea here is to get great donations for the Red Cross, and we'll come up with some sort of swag bag. Dave says sushi and beer. We'll have a damn good time. I promise you that we'll have a damn good time. And if you're lucky, you can take home Jeff Cannata afterwards as a parting gift.
Yeah. That's
how do you feel about that, Jeff?
I'm just finding out about it now, but it sounds like a fantastic idea.
Awesome.
It's a great party all around. Anyway, we would love for you to come bid on that. Again, playforjapan.org. There are a number of amazing things up for auction there. The very generous folks at Crystal Dynamics put up some fantastic stuff. Sega has put up a whole raft of goods that's just absolutely amazing. So please go check that out and bid and contribute as you can. All right, so we've got a ton of stuff today. We have a great, really, really high-caliber music guest this week. We've got David Ruffin Jr., who's laying on his track All My Life for us in the music break. And we've got tons of games. We've got great news. Let's not waste any more time, because a lot of you folks are listening to this one day or 2 days before picking up your 3DS. We've got two of them here.
Yeah, we've been street passing back and forth.
Yeah, you who didn't have your device in street pass mode in the first place.
Well, who am I going to pass other than you?
You don't know.
Yeah, it could be anybody.
By the way,
thousands of 3DSs out on the street right
there
now.
There are, actually, because you're right by Santa Monica, and where they happen to be running one of the big demo kiosks.
That's true.
There's a ton of people here. And look, I mean, if we have 3DSs early, I'm venturing a guess there's some other people around that might have them. You never know. You might walk by George Lucas while he's playing Lego Star Wars and get his Mii.
I could.
That would be amazing.
I could.
How cool would that be?
That would be cool. Yeah. I'm enjoying the experience so far of my 3DS. Are you?
Well, I think that, so let's look at two things. First, there's the hardware. Let's talk about the hardware first, because a lot of people are going to be looking at that $250 price tag. I think that if you're getting it on day one, you probably already decided you're getting it on day one, because you pre-ordered it, or you've, you know, you're going to go, you already decide I'm going to go stand in line for whatever free units there are. And it's more a question of, okay, when I get this thing home, how happy am I going to be with it? And that's a really tough question for me to answer.
I'll tell you, they nail that magic moment.
Really? What part of it was for you?
When you first turn it on, after you charge it, which, yeah. Why is Apple the only company that can charge, that can ship stuff already charged?
Who knows?
Anyway, when you charge it and you turn it on for the first time and it says, now we need to calibrate 3D technology. And it's like, what? And then it says calibrating. And then it, like, the screen like goes in and pops forward. It's like calibrating. That was really cool. I was like, that's a great way to differentiate it from, you know, like highlight its coolest feature.
Now, was it actually calibrating something or was it giving you a little like?
Yeah, I think it was dramatic. All right. A dramatic a presentation.
Right. Calibrating your expectations.
Exactly. Yeah. But I dug it. I thought it was a really good moment.
That's a really good point. It is calibrating expectations. That was a magic. See, that
I thought
funny.
That was like, a wonderful. When I was
sitting there going, get the fuck on with it. Come on.
When you open a new piece of hardware and you get all excited, and I'm like one of those guys that, like, I want to go through all the steps and, you know, set the time and date and get all, you know, I'm like, I'm enjoying this experience of having this new piece of hardware. And then it does that cool little presentation. I think that's a great moment.
That stuff is fun. I remember when we got our Sega CD for the first time and like the Sega CD logo came up and it does like rotation and zoom, which the Genesis couldn't do. And you're like, yeah, eat it, Super Nintendo. I can mode 7 this bitch too.
Yeah.
And scaling in and out. You want to see what your new tech can do.
Right.
Right up front.
And then all the software that comes prepackaged on the system is actually the most fun I've had with the system.
Oh, I totally. I've played five or six
different full games, but much like the experience I had taking home the Xbox 360 for the first time and bringing home, you know, oh god, what was the freaking shooter that Perfect Dark Zero and Call of Duty 2. I love those games. Well, love's a strong word, but anyway, the most fun I was having with that system was getting on Xbox Live Arcade and playing Geometry Wars and stuff. It's like, the stuff that I didn't think I would love the most is what I loved the most. Similarly here, playing the face shooting game, messing with the AR stuff, just taking photos in 3D is a blast. It's a blast. What are you going to do with those photos? Nothing.
Okay.
Nothing.
Wait, what is the face shooting game called?
Face Raiders. You're raiding faces.
You're rating them, not rating them.
Yeah, it's Face Raiders.
That sounds a little,
but it does a great job of taking the photo that you take of someone's face and then manipulating it so they have different expressions and they're, you know, and well, then not only that, but you have to find them in the world, so you have to actually physically rotate the 3DS in space, right? And then if you don't shoot them fast enough, they can break the background, so they cause a hole in time and space in your real view of your real world. It's cool.
That is pretty cool.
It's great.
For a mini game.
It differentiates it from the same experiences that I've had before, because as much as I'm enjoying, for example, Lego Star Wars Episode 3, or not Episode 3, but 3.
Clone Wars.
I'm enjoying it, and man, have they nailed the formula for making Lego games.
Surprise.
They can make those games ad infinitum because it is just a formula that works, is always fun, and even when I don't really love the source material that
Lego
they're parodying,
aliens.
That'd be pretty awesome.
Yeah, dude, that would be awesome.
That's why.
Game over, man.
Just bring back.
I wasn't kidding.
Online co-op to the Lego games. I know that's not necessarily 3DS relevant, but they had it in the early Star Wars ones,
relevant.
And they got rid of it for the later ones. But I feel like Space Raiders, it's a cool thing, and I guess it's cool because it's a portable system, and that's how you can play it. But typically, you know, you see people playing their portables on the bus or on the plane, and that's not where you're sitting there moving. It's like, sorry, middle seat guy. Like,
you'd be an obnoxious fucker playing this thing. You'd be like bumping into people. Like, even so, today I was playing in the office because it was really fun to kind of casually go, hey, I'm going to take your picture with my 3DS. And then I'm like shooting people, like taking Spectre's picture with that. Like, I'm going to blast your face off with this thing. And even then, it's like I'm standing in the office then, like turning around in space and like shooting stuff. And I'm like, I look like an idiot.
Yeah, it was like you were popping and locking.
Well, you do play with style.
Do you need a piece of cardboard there, Mr. G?
That's
like,
right.
No, I'm fine. I don't need a cardboard.
But I think just the first time you take a photograph with someone pointing at the camera,
because, yeah,
and then
well, you
look
have a cool
at
one.
It.
Okay, but
it's
the
awesome.
Only,
it's
the
a
only
cool...
place you can look at it is on your 3DS.
But it's not about, hey, I'm gonna document my life with this thing. It's not about sharing. Oh, honey, there's a great view. Grab the 3DS. Let's take a picture.
Let's be honest. The pictures you're taking with the 3DS with air quotes something pointing at the camera are the pictures that should be kept only on the 3DS.
Let me tell you, I'll be honest, I probably shouldn't say this, but dirty pictures with the 3DS, amazing. Amazing. Just saying.
Wow. Man, I can see the blush through the dark lights in the control room. It's amazing. So about at the hardware... There's a couple of things that strike me about this thing. I mean, first of all, it obviously basically is the DS shell. So all your old gear, like we pointed out in the pre-show, like my nice DS case I picked up in Japan fits this thing perfectly. So mm-hmm. if you have that sort of stuff, you're good. Now, of course, things that use the connections may or may not work because those are not in the same places. But if you have like, especially cases, those will work fine.
And it's cool that it comes with a little charging dock.
Yeah, I like that. Let's get to that. Let's do a couple other things about the device here. What do you think about the telescoping stylus?
I like it. I think
really?
I think it's kind of
annoying.
Why? Because you have to telescope it?
Yeah, because like I just want to pull it out and use it or pop it back in and when I'm done with it. Hmm. Do you guys have an opinion about telescoping styli? Not really. Okay, it's boring.
I mean, I think anything that's cumbersome and takes away from the game experience is annoying, but if you get used to it. The biggest change for me on the 3DS is I would keep expecting the stylus to be on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
It's stupid that that's something that small, but it's relearning where to react
completely
and grab.
I completely agree with you, dude. There's been numerous times where I've just like absentmindedly reached for it, and it not being there is annoying.
I had one of those like, shit, where are my keys? When I was playing at GDC, and I just went for it, and I was like, wait, I lost this. Oh, crap, I lost their stylus.
I've had this thing sitting next to my DS, which I took out of my DS case when I got it out. And I thought to myself, you know, actually, it's interesting the variances. I mean, look, you know, they've angled the edges of the thing. The design is much different. It has this super gloss finish. It has a sort of fade on the paint job across the top.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's as attractive. I think that like many of these Nintendo handhelds lately, the first pass on the industrial design isn't quite there yet.
I don't like how the top lid is slightly larger than the bottom lid or bottom half.
You mean like, oh,
like
wow.
How it goes out here?
That's weird. I hadn't even looked at that.
Yeah.
So if you look at it in profile, why does that bother you?
I don't know.
I think it's because when you grab it, you'll automatically know whether it's right side up or upside down.
Yeah, maybe that's a good thing.
What I don't like about it is, especially having looked at the DS, I find it really odd. I'm going to show this to the other guys. I find it really odd when I'm looking at it, the variation in like the top screen being a different width than the bottom screen. Because I've looked at DS for so long.
I like that.
It's weird to me.
Well, what it changes is that in the DS used to be that the bottom screen was sort of your main play area and the top screen was for display stuff in a lot of games.
Depends and that what you're is, playing. I mean, it's still you still have the touch capability on the bottom.
And now it means that the top screen is basically where your play area is going to be.
Always.
And the bottom screen is going to be a control unit, mostly.
True.
And I think that really changes things up. And it becomes clear right when you look at it, seeing the top screen as that widescreen view.
I guess. I mean... Again, looking at this thing, you've got like the sort of sparkle paint gray bottom, but then you've got like the black surround at the top. I mean, again, it sort of looks Apple. It looks very Apple-ish, I guess. That's a very Apple sort of design with the black gloss around. And you have to have the black around the screen at top. I mean, I think otherwise it wouldn't frame out well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think that the 3DS 2, whatever the hell it will be a nice... improvement, or will be the one to be like nice improvement over this. You'd be like, oh, I don't think
it'll be as big a deal as the fat to the light.
No, you're probably right. It probably won't be as much of a deal from the fat to the light, because with the fat they were still really pioneering the entire design structure of this thing, which they already do have that part down.
Yeah.
I also miss having fooled around with XLs. I miss the size of the XL screens. I still think those are nice.
Yeah, you
devices.
Love that. You're really the biggest fan of XL.
I really do love the XLs. And so last but not least, if this is going to become your replacement and you have a lot of DS titles, there's some bad news for you about the DS titles.
Yeah.
They don't look so good.
Yeah. In fact, I know a lot of places like GameStop are running the turn in your old DS and we'll give you a discount on the new one.
Mm-hmm.
I would advise against that, especially if you're an avid DS player. You might want to retain that as your...
But are you really going to play?
Well, what's the problem? Is it aspect problem or screen resolution problem?
It's a screen resolution problem. Therein lies the gist of the matter, is that the screen resolution is different, so everything is getting pixel jumped or whatever, and so it looks muddy and washed, and it's just I've only played around with it a little bit. I'm going to do much more before I like write a final review of the hardware, but I think that's a weakness. That also really concerns me because about what's going to happen with the DSware conversion stuff.
Like the GBA downloads too, right? I mean, how are you going to, because GBA games looked great on a DS.
So the GBA games I've seen, because they did have those at New York, they window boxed them. Mm. And so they looked fine. Because if you keep in mind, like that screen was smaller. That's not a big deal. It's the like stretched and play to get it into this thing where it looks right in the top screen that just doesn't work. And that's disappointing because my home unit has been just a plain DS. I hadn't had access to DSi. There's a lot of DSiWare games I thought were really cool, but just never had access to. I thought was looking forward to. Of course, you know what will happen is it'll run its course, and in like 6 to 8 months, we'll just be buying 3DS stuff anyway.
Yeah, and I mean, that's kind of what happened with the iPad to iPhone thing was, you know, the iPad came out and it's going to play all the iPhone games you wanted, and you can just download them, no problem. And it's like, well, yeah, but it's stretched and it looks crappy and nobody wants to do that, and so everything got updated. So maybe you'll see updates online for 3DS versions of DSi.
You're standing there in the store, you got your 3DS box in your hand, what game should you get?
Well, for me, the answer is Super Street Fighter 3D.
No disagreement about that at all.
That is a gorgeous showpiece for the system. It plays great. I think the use of the touchscreen to have programmable combos is pretty smart and is an elegant solution to not having six face buttons to use. And I love the three-quarter 3D view that you can select. It really makes the 3D pop and is a fun thing to show off to your friends as well.
What are you guys thinking about if you're like looking at 3DS lineup?
Super seems like the game to go, but I'm interested by Steel Diver.
Yes.
I mean, I feel like that utilized, like as a showpiece, like that kind of uses, it has a gyroscope, 3D, you're moving stuff around. Have you guys had a chance? I mean, that's what I'm interested in, but I don't know if it's the $40 I want to spend.
Therein lies the crux of the problem with that game and with Pilot Wings is that both of these games are really cool first-party games. They're put together with a good degree of polish. They look like a lot of fun. I find it increasingly difficult to say, well, this is a $35 jump relative to what you could buy for $5 on an app. And I know people go like, well, like iPhone defenders and detractors, just table that argument. We've heard that argument a million times. The bottom line for me, the way I look at it, is portable gaming device to portable gaming devices. I've come with an expectation of like game dev story for $5 is a hell of a lot of game. Really well thought out. Lots of stuff going on in it. And I can't say that Pilot Wings or Steel Diver go like seven times past that. Really?
Yeah, but I would say Lego Star Wars. I would say Madden. I would say Street Fighter. Mm-hmm. Of the games that I've played, Ridge Racer. If you're into that, I think those are substantial game experiences. What are the other ones that I?
How much are you guys looking forward to playing in 3D?
I've only played probably 3 or 4 different DS games at this point, and you know, it's neat. It's I don't know if it's $300 neat.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with 3D, and this especially comes into play with this handheld, is that you know they're using a divided lens system where they're just splitting, and you know you have to be in such the right position to get the ocular effect to work that it's too sensitive to really be conducive to action games. Like I find Madden to be really difficult to play,
really
because there's so much like you're jostling, there's so much moving around. It's really hard to keep my face in that right spot to where it's working all the time. As a matter of fact, like that's another like those spatial relationship things come in. Have you played the AR games much?
Yeah, I have. I really like them.
I think it's really cool, but it's such an event game because you have to have the right place to play it. Because you have to be able to move all the way around the table. You need a lot of light.
Right.
Like I can't play it in my den on my coffee table because the light, like the down lights in my den, don't put enough light on the table to make it work. I have to go over to my like breakfast nook and like put it on my kitchen table. So that seems like a pain in the neck. And then if you don't keep the card like 14 inches away from the cameras, or if it loses it for a minute, it like freaks out. It's fun. Don't get me wrong, they're really fun. They're cool. I really like that. But I like that struck me now why the NGP AR thing at GDC was so cool.
So cool.
because they didn't have to keep that big blanket. I mean, like, once they had created the AR piece, they're just like looking around the room, and like the AR thing is created in the room, and it's just there.
Is that a technological difference, or
it's a huge difference?
Because I saw a video online of the guys doing a life-size Mii, and all they did was just print out a larger version of the card, and they just calculated how the relationship of size of Mii to card, and then just created, you know, proportionally a human size
with the DS.
With the DS.
The problem I have though is, and maybe it's only in this game, but it seems like you have to have the card in the camera's field of view. So if I'm like moving around or whatever and the card leaves the field of view, then the AR crashes and it tells me I can't see the card anymore.
Mm-hmm. So it's using that as like the main hub of focal
necessary
point.
Anchor.
Yeah.
Necessary anchor.
Well, especially because those games, the only thing that's happening is happening on the card. It's
right.
There's not other stuff going on. Yeah.
So
that may be a software thing more than a hardware thing.
Could be. So Steel Diver, to then get to that point, is that the thing about it is you're playing in 3D and you're using gyroscopes and all that, you have to be really careful
to hold
that thing stationary in front of your face when you're using it as a periscope.
I mean, it seems similar to other console launches. I mean, it's got the sizzle, it's got the 3D. For Jeff, it had that initial wow factor of calibrating, and hopefully the games will come. I mean, it's rare that a system hits with, this is awesome, the game's totally justified. It's like, no, this is fucking cool, and now...
I want to say that above and beyond the 3D, it bears mentioning that Street Fighter and even Lego Star Wars. Lego Star Wars stood out to me because I played so many Lego games on the DS, and it is substantially better looking even with the 3D completely off. It is a much better looking version of that Lego game that we all know and love, and I think the that formula works really well, and the experience of playing that game is substantially better on this new hardware.
So. All right. Well, I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about 3DS games in the coming weeks, especially as more people get them. I think that I'll wrap up my part on 3DS, that the most intriguing, interesting, and cool part about the hardware to me is how far they've come with the connectivity parts. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, we all know how cool it's going to be to have, you have a gamer card now, and then you can trade that. And so you do trade your codes once, and then you know when your friends are online. It's very much Xbox Live-like or PSN-like. That's really cool. I think that probably the coolest part is, and this is really, to me, an acid test to how well it works in North America, is, you know, in Japan, we have, especially, you know, like in Tokyo and Osaka, you've got these like population density of people playing together, and you can do ad hoc stuff. It's no big deal to have an active sort of like, we need to be together to play.
Right.
The passive nature of Street Pass really, I think, builds an interesting bridge for North America and Europe, where we're a little more spread out, and it gives us the ability to still have that like quasi-social game experience of like trading Miis and all that kind of stuff. And trading our, you know, like, and like the Street Fighter game, which has that really cool, like, you set up your little battle team and it fights their battle team just when you go in passing. If, like I could see that working when I'm walking down the promenade or going to the mall or in the airport or wherever. And I don't have to have that same density like I have in Japan, where I've always been, you know, envious of that because I'm like, well, that's a really cool thing. But I just don't know where to do that in North America, especially not in L.A.
Yeah, and you don't have to seek anybody out. It can just happen on its own. My only concern with all of that, and I know you're not as concerned as I am, but it's battery life. Battery life on this is not as robust as it was
on the first DS.
And I could find myself getting really annoyed and just going, you know what? Screw Street Pass. I'm turning this off.
Now, I'll say this. I've had the same life expectancy with battery that everybody else has playing games, about 3.5 hours or so. However, I've been leaving mine on all the time. Like, because one of the things you want to do is you want to walk around with this thing in your pocket because you earn points for your steps, which gives you coins to buy stuff.
Yeah.
And I have not had a lot of degradation in standby mode. The battery has not really run down a lot in that mode, because I'm thinking it's like pretty well shut down. But yeah, like playing the games, especially in 3D, it puts a tax on it.
I think Snake Eater will be. I'm excited to see what Kojima does, because they did awesome stuff with the PSP, you know, Wi-Fi access, sharing. So I'm excited to see what they do for Snake Eater. But it's a genius move by Nintendo, because it answers that question of, well, I always have my iPhone with me, I carry it with me, so I'm always going to play. Well, now you have a reason to always have your 3DS with you. And if you have it with you, you're more likely to play on that than, you know, some
that's a really good
99
point.
Cent game.
Really smart. Like the steps thing is like an
that
encouragement to keep
genius,
it in your pocket.
Really.
And then you've got it in your pocket, so then the Street Pass stuff happens, so then you think that's cool, and if they can get that little ecosystem like spinning, then that would be a really cool way to get people interested in 3DS.
Yeah, it's sort of Pokemonizing the entire system.
Pokemon, okay.
You know, in the sense of collecting, sharing with people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Even the little puzzle game where you have to find other Miis in the world, and they have a puzzle piece in their area that you can get from them. It's very Pokemon.
Or the one where you're trying to rescue me. We should get with the rescuing.
I could rescue you. I'll rescue you. I'll use my sword and my magic.
So before we get to break, let's talk about something else other than 3DS. I don't know. What have you been playing, Christian?
This is a nice segue. Mortal Kombat, which I got a lot of hands-on time at GDC when I was there for Game Rant, and then the PS Plus version of it is out, and I played a lot of that in 3D, and I liked Mortal Kombat's 3D. I'm excited about this full release. I think it's interesting comparing Mortal Kombat Reboot to games like Marvel vs. Capcom 3 or Street Fighter 4, where Street Fighter did such a great job of taking the classic formula of Street Fighter 2 and bringing it back, updating it, but giving you enough new. And Mortal Kombat's really going for that same approach. I think it's interesting because if you look at, you know, if you have your fact sheet, it compares, I think, pretty similarly to Marvel vs. Capcom 3 in the sense that you can do teams, you can tag in and out. It has, you know, a super bar at the bottom, a air quote super bar that builds up for your X-ray moves, you know, special moves, but it plays so differently. I mean, you wouldn't say, oh, it plays like Marvel. No, completely different game. But I think they've nailed the weight and feel to the fighters, especially just adding little things like the sound effects for Cyrax and the robot guys. I think Sector really, it hits well. Like, it feels strong and like you're playing with a robot. My knock against Mortal Kombat has always been fatality fatigue or special move fatigue, where it's okay. Like, you've seen it, you've done it. And I think it's interesting that I hold that against Mortal Kombat. It's like the big moves here are the X-ray moves. You build them up, and then you unleash this powerful X-ray move. But each character has one X-ray move. And just in the time I've played it, you know, the few hours I've played the game, it's, well, I've seen it. There's Kano's. It's cool. I've seen it. But yet I don't hold that same prejudice against a game like Marvel, where each guy has one, you know, you have different supers, but the super animation is always the same. I'm never like, oh, here comes Ryu's super, boring. And I don't know why, you know, I have the feeling towards one and not the other, but I don't know. Have you guys had time with Mortal Kombat? I think they're doing a lot
right. Oh, I have.
Right.
Oh, I think they're doing a lot. Yeah, I think you nailed all the pieces for me. I think it has a lot of the it's very quick to change spacing, which I thought was always a hallmark of Mortal Kombat. And by that, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, obviously you have a couple of characters that have grab and pulls, but you have a very quick of in close fight and then you're separated and then in close fight and then you're separated. There's a lot of quick back and forth. The impact of all of the attacks, especially, you know, any of the higher level attacks, has a really nice meaty chunkiness to it. I think maybe this fatigue thing you're talking about is simply because it's like, you know, it's so over the top.
So visceral.
It's so visceral that you just sort of get over, you know, you get overloaded with it. Whereas, you know, right, Ryu's is a little more, like, great example. Like, you know, a fireball punch is such a signature element, but it's not like blood and guts and all this other crap. But at the same time, I mean, it's a good point. Like, those are the supers. I mean, that is the thing of it.
So are there, I mean, do they do any of that crazy stuff like Beybalities or something, whatever, where you can mix those instead?
We haven't seen that yet,
or?
But the fatalities are gruesome.
And they've said there'll be DLC fatalities, so I could see if there's demand for it, you can do. But what I have to say, really, Mortal Kombat's always done great, is they have a great single-player game. Yep. I love Capcom fighting games. Single-player, it's arcade or training, whatever. The Challenge Tower in Mortal Kombat, it's creative, it's different, it keeps you playing, where if you don't want to play online, it really gives single-players a fighting game that's fun. But to answer, yeah, I could see a DLC Babality if it's...
But
know.
MK Online is going to be awesome.
Because oh, be.
MK is just off the hardcore for most people enough that you can get in and have a good time. And again, this is maybe where the viscerality comes back and has fun. It's like, it's pretty easy to have fun, even if you're getting your ass kicked. Because when you land a few of those good shots, they look really cool and they're very satisfying.
Jump in, kick cool. Some ass, blow some shit up.
Mortal Kombat. Nice.
Yeah, all right. Well, you won't have to wait long for that, but you'll have to wait a little bit extra to get Duke. How about that, folks?
Yeah.
Come in the front page.
Wait, what?
Coming up in the front page, we're going to talk about a slight delay for Duke Nukem. Hey,
this is
I don't make this stuff up. I can't help it, right? You know, what can I say? Jeff's going to talk some about Crysis 2 when we come back on the other side. The other Jeff is going to talk about Shogun. We've got all that and more coming up on the other side of this break. You know, between all those 3DS games and Crysis 2, Homefront, and Shift 2, there's a whole lot of games to get this week, and I don't know if you could buy all of them, so why not try out renting them from GameFly? You will get your game shipped directly to your door. All you have to do is set it up online. You can go by GameFly.com. And, of course, we've got a code for you, a good code, I think. Click on that joystick in the upper right-hand corner. Type in the code CONFIRMED. Buy your first month, and we will back it up with a second month for free. Yes, it's a BOGO. Buy one, get one free. So give it a shot, you know? Try out some games. Get Shift 2, Crysis, or your 3DS stuff right to your door from GameFly. If only you guys could see Jeff rocking the shimmy back and forth. He loves that beat.
It's a good beat.
You do love that beat.
Squonk, squink.
That's good.
That's it.
Dude, you are right there. Not a beatboxer. All right, coming up here in a little bit in the warning, we're going to talk about, among other things, whether or not game critics are too soft on AAA games.
Soft.
Yes. We're all too soft on AAA games. Are you? Never mind. Let's just cut that line of conversation right there. All right, Jeff Mattis.
Yes.
You've been getting conquered in Shogun 2.
Yeah, I've been getting...
So what's the story here, Bob?
Well, it is... The short story is that it is a fantastic strategy game that is brutally kicking my ass on a regular basis, but in sort of a good way, because it's not one of those things where I'm like, you know, feel like the game is being unfair. I just feel that it's, you know, there's a lot going on in the game. There's a ton of different skill trees and stuff like that going on. The on-the-field action is great.
Skills don't just grow on trees.
They don't. But yeah, you have. They do in this case. They just grow on trees in Shogun 2. So yeah, a ton of different stuff you can do in the game. You know, as in previous Total War games.
I would say, let's roll this up for a second. Total War series has been around for a long time.
Yeah.
Grand-scale conflict.
Right.
Likes to take a historic perspective, very tactical in their ground combat, very important to use combined arms,
right,
and make sure that you are using good on-field tactics, flanking, backing up your infantry, and that sort of thing.
And simulation, right? It's the idea is trying to simulate these battles.
Yes, yes, it's definitely on a simulation.
With large numbers of troops.
Right.
So with that piece of history, what makes Shogun 2 unique, and where have they gone with Shogun 2?
Well, Shogun 2, it takes place, I guess it starts off in like mid-15th century Japan.
Sure.
Sengoku period. So it's basically during the time when Japan was in sort of a transitional phase. There was a lot of social upheaval. There was a lot of different clans were at war with each other, and everybody was sort of vying for control to be Shogun of Japan. And so that it kind of throws you into that world where whether you're playing a short campaign, a medium campaign, or a long campaign, your ultimate goal is to conquer a certain number of territories, and then including Kyoto, which you have to conquer and hold for a season. The game's turns are broken up into seasons, so it's like, you know, spring, summer, fall, and winter. Really cool graphical changes when you see these turn changes. So winter looks like winter, summer looks like summer.
You're talking about at the global level.
At the global level, yes.
Because I thought that was one of the cool... When they came and demoed it for us, I thought one of the coolest things that they did was how much effort they made in doing a really good global strategic level game to go with their... They've always had good tactical game.
Right.
They really upped the ante on the strategic side of it.
Yes, that is very true. In fact, it's... The depth of it probably rivals Civilization in a lot of ways, but also surpasses it in a lot of ways. It's also very more... combat focused. So while you do have stuff in the game like diplomacy and you know making alliances with other factions and stuff like that, ultimately you're going to have to go to war with these folks, most likely. I mean, you can keep a few allies in there.
It is a military sims focused.
Yeah,
game.
Yeah, yeah. It's not like you're gonna, you know, conquer people with your culture and stuff like that.
Although you're not really gonna do that in Civ 5 either.
Yeah, that's true. So anyway, you basically go out and you're building your armies and conquering territories, and then The Shogun, the current Shogun, is actually keeping an eye on you. So the more powerful you become, you'll actually get these warnings where, like, the Shogun's starting to pay attention to you and your clan. And you get to a certain point in the game, and it depends entirely on how you build up your forces and how powerful you become, how quickly. But eventually the Shogun will declare you an enemy of Japan. And
then some House of Flying Daggers shit goes down.
Yeah, I mean, it's like all the territories, regardless of who you've allied with, who you have trade agreements set up with, all that sort of stuff kind of goes out the window, and all of a sudden everyone's attacking you. So it gets very, very difficult, at least for me. Like I said, it's really good. I'm having a lot of fun with it, but it is definitely a learning process.
Are there difficulty levels that you can switch?
Yes, I'm most of my time has been spent on normal, and normal is doing a pretty good job of kicking my ass. Mm-hmm. A lot of that has to do with the fact that, you know, I'll get several hours into a campaign, and while the game does have an in-game encyclopedia, which is very, very useful, there's a lot of, like, a bit of trial and error over long periods of time, because you're building up structures and buildings and your armies and trying to manage your economy and tax rates and all that sort of stuff. And you'll get to a point where you're like, oh man, you know, 2 years ago, I really should have done this thing.
Oh.
You know, like, I really should have, you know, built a sake den so I can start recruiting ninja or whatever.
And ninjas require sake?
Yes, sake dens.
Oh, sake.
That's where they. And then you can actually, like.
Dude, you didn't know that. You got to give them the nihonshu. If you don't give them the. Otherwise, they're like, we're not working for you, Buster.
Right. So.
And so after you finish a campaign, you graduate with a PhD from Harvard in feudal Japan, and then you get a tenured job at Princeton teaching.
I have yet to finish a campaign, but I would imagine that you're at least in the running for one of those. So, some sort of certification.
So, Jeff, for people who are listening and, like, thinking about, like Shogun 2 is a cool game, but I'm not sure I'm going to enjoy it. How high would you say the intimidation factor is? Like, what would you tell them to help ease their concerns that they might not have fun with it?
Well, okay. If you're at all interested in the time period, it's really cool. The art is really great. All the unit cards are, you know, look like Japanese paintings and stuff. Very neat. Music is awesome. Like, the battle music, you've got the,
oh, nice.
You know, the drums, the gung, 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 gung stuff. Yeah. Yeah. And then you've got, like, really tranquil music during the, you know, strategic part of it and stuff. So, but it's all, you know, Japanese themed, very cool stuff. As far as, like, would I recommend this to somebody who doesn't normally play strategy games?
You could just say it. No.
No, I really wouldn't. This isn't a good jumping off point. I mean, if you really want to dive in and, you know, want a game that you're going to have to spend some time with to learn the systems and get your feet wet, if you're that kind of person, then yeah, for sure. But this isn't really a...
How much horsepower do you think you need? What are you running it on?
Just a Core 2 Duo. I mean, I have a really good 6950 Radeon HD.
Right, so you're in good shape there.
So, yeah. I mean, it's running really well. It's all maxed out and everything, so...
All right.
One of these days, I'll have to tell you guys about the board game called Shogun that is badass and reminded me...
I used to play that.
Did you play that?
Yes.
Ah, really?
So imagine that with about, you know, a dozen or so more layers stuff to it, at least, you know.
You with the dice tower and everything? Rad.
It was like Axis and Allies, sort of.
Kind of, but it had seasons, and you have to feed your people. Mm-hmm. And
like Fireball Island.
Kind of.
I love Fireball Island. That's the only board game I play.
It's a great game. It's out of print.
I know.
So, anyway.
Anywho.
You guys are all looking at me, and I'm just sort of like...
That game is a remake of Wallenstein.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Yes, Wallenstein.
So, there you go.
I think I went to school with his son. Jimmy Wallenstein.
Frankenstein?
Franken-Wallenstein.
Fire bad.
It's cool about the drums, because, you know, I do love my drums, and I got to play some Patapon 3
Patapon.
Like, it's so cool to me, and, you know, like, PSP hasn't had a lot of success in America. It had great success in Japan, but hasn't had a ton of success here, but there's still so many cool, distinct, and unique titles that are not duplicated in any way, shape, or form anywhere else. And Patapon is way up there on that list because, like, who else would think of a game that was a strategy game where you control what your troops do in a side-scrolling attack screen by giving them orders with the battle drums? It's so cool. I've played both the game. I played 1 and 2, loved them. And, like, 3 picks right up. Although it has a couple of changes that I'm not sure how I'm going to respond to when I have the full game to play them. And the biggest change of all is that of course, the end of two, you were like super victorious and everybody's very, very happy and excited. And this chapter opens with them having opened a basically Pandora's box that turned the entire cast of Patapons to stone. They're all stone.
Oh, bummer.
Every single one of them is stone. And you only reanimate three of them. And so instead of having a big army of dudes with you, you just have these three other support Patapon. And each of them is the archetype for their skill development tree. So if you guys play Patapon, and also this doesn't like glaze
over.
So you remember how you had all the skills for each of the different warrior types and you could build them? So now take each one of those types that you could build them into and make them an archetype, and you have three of them, and then you have skills for each of them that you can branch out into to develop them how you want to bring them along with you.
Cool.
So that part's cool, but it really makes it... I got to play with an unlocked version, so I skipped forward to like a really late battle, and it's really changing the dynamic of how you play the game, because any one of those guys is now super, super important. Like, you really, really have to watch them, which means you have to really pay attention, because it's like, because look, Patapon's basically a game of looking at your opponent and figuring out what the right attack defend sequence is and knowing when to hit the retreat and when to hit the regroup and when to attack and press forward. And you really have to be, there's a lower margin for messing that up now, because if you lose one of your guys, you lost like an entire third of your force, which makes it really difficult. So that part's really challenging.
I love that they're making these, but who are they making them for?
I have no idea. I guess me?
Yeah, no one bought, not when people bought the first one. Then the second one, I think the second one was great compared to the first one. And but this one, I mean, I played one and two. I mean, if someone hasn't played any Patapon, are they going to get this one versus the $5?
Right. And it sort of seems like the idea of streamlining it is to address, well, if you haven't played Patapon, now it's going to be easier to play. But if you hadn't played Patapon on it already, are you really going to get attracted? Because you're going to be like, what the hell? Like,
how many people come in the third game in the series? Like, how many newcomers?
Of a PSP game.
Of a PSP game.
On top of it all.
With the NGP already announced and people sort of tuned out to PSP. Which makes me sad, because it's so, it's such an awesome series, and it's so cool and so fun. And there's so many, again, all of the weapon customization comes back into this. There's the Great Forge with a tremendous amount of items to be collected. One thing that they've done exclusively for the North American version is that they've included a full, more than a manual, but less than a Prima guide, a sort of hold your hand and help you understand what to do next.
Remember? That's cool.
You were in Patapon 2, you had to keep on going back to levels, and you'd get like, oh, I'm six, you know, I'm six wood cuttings down.
You'd grind, basically.
Yeah, and you had to go back and grind, but you were like, it was never like clear, should I go back to the desert and grind, or to forest and grind? Or where do I need to go to get the parts I need to get? Now it has a manual that you pop up in the game, in the North American version, and it's sort of like, well, right now you need this, this, and this, and you could get this, this, and this by playing this, or this, or this, or this.
Well, that's cool.
And each of the missions, when you go to the little, like the window of which area you're going to go into, has all of the different missions that are in there, and you can just pick the one you want to play and go play that mission inside that part of the environment.
So that's really streamlined then in terms of, that's awesome.
That part's really cool. And then the other thing they added that's really neat is all of your Patapons have skills and special abilities. So again, in addition to building up their innate abilities, they also have active abilities, and you can equip different ones, and you have to sort of learn which ones to equip for which mission you're going on.
So like, what are some of the things you can do?
Like improved health, improved range. Like your archer guy could get like an improved archery range, or he could get like a buff to his like poison arrow or his elemental arrow, or it could be like fire does 20% more damage for your elementalist.
Oh, cool.
So, and you have to like, or you could get converse to that. You get like extra fire resistance. So unfortunately to me, that sort of telegraphs also a trial and error method. Because it means you got to go into the mission and learn, oh, I just got my ass waxed because I couldn't do X.
Oh, do they give you any sort of briefing pre-mission?
You know, I was breezing through this preview pretty quickly, so I didn't see a ton. There's like, you know, like the old lectern, you know, here's the intro to what's going on. But dude, I mean, people click through that shit all day.
But was it beautiful? I love the design elegance, the color palette. It's just, it's
Same
black. Well, black, but contrasted on. I remember in the first one, you got to the it looked like a sunset. The sky, it was just the burning colors in the background. And
so I hopped forward to this desert land that was really fucking cool. It was like, it had that same sort of weird, like, yellow, orange, beautiful glow to it. But all of the, like, flora and fauna in it had this almost, like, Seussian look to it with, like, you know, great, I don't know. How do you describe Sousa's stuff? It just has like that weird, like very soft and curvy and
tubular.
Tubular. Yeah. It was like really cool. I was like, wow, this is really cool.
And everything rhymes.
Just... Yes, everything rhymed. Yeah. It was all about the rhyming. The other thing that they're doing, and again, Christian, this address is like making it easier, is it on the fly adapts to your ability to stay in rhythm.
Oh, that's cool.
So, and that works in both directions. So if you're not playing well, it opens up the windows a little bit. I mean, I think like it's not going to make, I tried, you can fail out still. It just sort of like gives you a little more. But as you get better and better and better, the more you chain up, then like when you hit the fevers, maintaining your fevers becomes progressively more difficult because it keeps getting tighter and tighter and tighter to where you really need to be on the beat. Hmm.
So you, me, and four other people are now super excited.
Yeah. You should be excited. It's really fucking good. It's really good. It'll be one of those games that I'll dust off my PSP, charge it back up, and I will play.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, I love this game. And the other thing about Patapon that's
awesome.
You say
that right in front of your 3DS.
No. It's listening.
It'll also be one of the great games. It'll be a great game to like, it'll be a game that I take to bed.
Well,
so it is beautiful.
You know what I mean. Like, put on the headphones and like lay there in the dark and this is not getting better.
I know what you, it encapsulated or represented what Bit Trip kind of want. You know, you get into that zen.
Yeah.
And like where Bit Trip is super hard, but you just kind of zone out and you're like,
yep.
You know, get the drum and bass going and Patapon does
that. I did not do that for Bit Trip. Bit Trip was like, God damn it, I can't go upstairs. Stairs!
Bit Trip is really good.
I'm talking about Runner.
Well, Bit Trip Beat is really good on your iPad because it's a bigger screen. So I'm playing it on my iPad 2, which I play while I'm listening to a podcast, Stand Up, Sit Down, which is almost as good as the Wii game GoldenEye.
Oh,
yes!
He did it. He hit the trifecta.
Thank you. Well done.
Well done. We're going to start accepting challenges like that as soon as we get our iPad. I like this idea. And I didn't realize Bit Trip was on iPad. That's awesome.
Well, it's on iPhone, and on iPhone it's a little small and cumbersome because it's tilt control or, you know, touch control. But when the graphics are bitty anyway, so when you blow it up to fill the iPad screen, it works really well, and it's really awesome.
So, Jeff,
yes,
you've been playing the shooter of the week.
Yes. Crisis 2.
Which I got a copy of today, so I'm curious to see your
crisis
thoughts.
Crisis averted.
Yeah, I finished it.
That's part three.
And I'm blown away by this game. Blown away.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
There's been a lot of shooters in the last few weeks that have come out. I really enjoyed Bulletstorm, as I said many times in the show. I enjoyed Killzone. I enjoyed... Homefront, you know, as you all know, I think Crysis 2 is the most satisfying of the bunch. Although I think Bulletstorm has a fun that is really unique to it, but Crysis 2 is absolutely the single player experience is intense. It's lengthy campaign, and it is epic. There are epic moments over and over again. The shooting is awesome. You feel overpowered in a lot of ways, and a lot of people may find ways to game the system a little bit with some of the powers. Like, for instance, I think the shielded mode that you can get into is a little overpowered.
Are you talking about the armor up?
Yes.
Okay.
Especially when you put points into it, because once you start killing aliens, you can harvest their little alien DNA and spend that to upgrade your nano suit.
Spoiler.
Well,
so
that's not a spoiler.
I don't want to detract too much from this game, but comparing this to Homefront, which you loved, but super short, but it was also built around epic moments where...
Well, I think I enjoy the story of in Crysis 2 is not its strength by any stretch of the imagination at any point. But I found myself compelled by Homefront's story, and that's why I really enjoyed that
game. I wanted to be in that situation. I wanted to kill those damn Koreans and for what they did to our home soil. I felt like I was in that world, right?
Right.
But the moment-to-moment experience of Crysis, I think, is superior from a pure video game shooter level. I've never...
And this was on 360, right?
I played on 360, and I think it's the best-looking console game I have ever played. The thing that blew me away...
Uncharted 3 just perked its ears, I think.
For sure. I actually had this argument on live just last night with Dan Jevons. I was like, really? Really? Because I...
It's... Dude, I'll just say one thing right off the top that knocked me off my socks.
Knocked you off your socks?
I was sitting on socks, and it knocked me right on off. It keeps my butt warm.
Wait, you can put socks on your butt? How do you do that?
I just sit on them. The game plays on the 360. You guys don't want to hear this. The game plays on the 360 in 1080p.
So the demo didn't represent... Because the demo didn't blow me away. Graphically.
Well, it's a multiplayer demo, right?
Right. So everything scaled back from the single player awesomeness. Yeah.
What's the significance you're attempting to make about it playing at 1080p?
Most games don't. Most games are in 720p. Well, and the game looks that good and is in 1080p, I was very impressed. It looks stunning. It's quite impressive. And
so I guess what I'm trying to get to is, are you attributing part of why it looks so good to the fact that it is running at that higher resolution?
I think yes. I mean, it looks good because it's in that resolution, and also the fact that it's pushing the visuals it's pushing, and it's also able to do it at 1080p.
Frame rate hold up for you?
Frame rate? There were a couple moments when there was like a really crap ton of enemies really close to me. Sometimes there were once or twice, but almost... Very little problem with that. Very little.
Jeff, we need to get you running this on your PC.
Yeah, we do.
Because we really need to bring the PC element in here.
For sure.
Because this is a PC game first, and I think there's a huge...
It's great that the first achievement that you unlock on the 360...
Oh, I saw the same thing on... It's saying the first trophy you unlock on PS3.
Yeah. Can it play Crysis?
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. But let me just talk a little bit about what makes, I think, the game so impressive to me. You know, it's set in New York City, the real New York City,
right.
Under alien attack. And the alien attack happens right at the beginning. So there's no, you know, qualms about the fact that you're playing an alien attack through the whole thing. And I've never felt more like I'm in a real city in any video game before. And I think that is due to, A, the graphics, and B, the density of the environments. Okay. There is so much stuff in your view at all times. And... Indoor environments, outdoor environments, everything looks really real. The art design is spectacular. You feel like you're winding in and out of skyscrapers. You're on rooftops of skyscrapers. You're inside buildings. You come out on city streets, and the city streets are strewn with cars and items, and there is so much stuff all the time.
There's almost a natural density of what would happen if there was a population center that got blown up?
Yes.
But it's all linear, right? I mean, you see all this stuff and you can't go, ooh, that's, building.
Yeah,
it's,
that's the question.
You have one path to follow.
Well, most of the game is actually set up in these environments where you enter an area and it's like a tiny sandbox in that is limited. You enter an area and
mysterious voice goes, tactical options available.
Yeah, and then you can pull up your visor, and it shows you, and it highlights some things like if you go over here, you can stealth them. If you go over here, you can flank them. There's a turret that you can use over here. So it points out sort of features of its level design that you may not see, or that another game might let you discover on your own.
Right.
So that might be a turnoff to people. I found it to be pretty cool that I walked into a new place. There's a bunch of enemies. I get to decide how I'm going to take them down using the three sort of main prongs of your suit, your stealth, armor, or power.
Can you change your mind on the fly? Like if you're doing stealth and then you're like, oh, crap, run over to the turret. I mean, it doesn't lock you.
No, you know what I mean? Yeah, it's just a big – there's just options available, and you can tag them, and so it will always have a marker where those
things
are.
So the trade-off that you have to work with here is that to go into that tactical mode, you have to raise your visor – which means you're not holding your gun. So you cannot shoot. You cannot use your weapon at the same time you're doing your tactical planning. So you do your tactical planning, you mark everything up, you put your visor back down, and you pull your gun back
up. But then
up.
The marks retain.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So it's like you're doing pre-attack planning,
right?
And then you hop into the situation.
Is that meant to be?
I just
like,
want to clarify that.
Sure.
Like a Dead Space type thing. Like you're live in the game, so it's, you know, balancing to pulling up your tactical versus your risk reward.
You're
kind of
always
thing.
Live in the game, even upgrading your systems. Like you, your hand comes up, and each finger is a different thing that you can put money into. Or when you're changing out your weapon loadout, like you pull your gun up close to you, and you can change the scope or the muzzle. You can put a silencer on, and it all happens in game. You never
that's kind of cool. I
like
you're
never paused when you're doing that stuff.
That's cool.
Which I really like that. It integrates the whole experience. But the single player campaign is so impressive to me. It's
but
it's
not
everything.
Because of the story.
No, the story is not good. It's convoluted and odd and doesn't make any sense at the end. But there are so many wonderful moments, not story moments, but just epic experience moments of being a survivor in an alien attack on a real United States city.
So this is basically like the old July 4th Will Smith movie.
I think it's more like Battle Los Angeles, except Battle New York.
But Battle Los Angeles wasn't very good.
I liked Battle Los Angeles a lot. You would know that if you went to JeffCanada.com and saw
it. Would be cool to play through, right? Just because it's not a fun movie to watch doesn't mean... I mean, I could see how you'd be
cool. Can for 45 minutes and $10 on XBLA.
Yeah.
Right. That is true.
There's these intense moments where, like, you'll be on a bridge and the entire bridge collapses underneath you. And if you'll allow me a spoiler, if I can duly note it, there is one moment toward the end where an entire, like, the entire chunk of Central Park is ripped out of the ground and brought into the sky, like, a mile up. And then you get on a helicopter and you fly to it. And the next level is you're on floating Central Park.
That's right,
infested
that's fucking
with
cool.
It. That's
right,
yeah,
that's
so
that's cool.
Awesome.
All right, that's cool.
It is
I'll
so
give you that's
awesome.
Cool.
There are many moments that are like that. I mean, and you are in all kinds of different parts of New York. Of course, there's going to be a Times Square battle that is incredible.
Well,
and it looks like fucking Times Square. I've never felt more like I'm really in this city.
So let me ask you a question. So on Wednesday, I grabbed a copy out of the... Actually, Sean got his Gamefly copy sent straight to the office. And we put it in. We got a PS3, as a matter of fact. Mm. And what stood out to me about... And I know they were going for this, like, you don't exactly know what's going on deal.
Yeah.
It's so heavy that, like, I'm still was at the end of that going... What the fuck is happening, and why am I doing any of this, and why do I even care?
Yeah.
And I especially, like, I really, like, on top of, like, not even understanding the story, I didn't even completely understand all of what I had at my disposal. Like I was joking about that voice. He comes on and says, tactical options available. And I'm like, what do you mean? Do you mean that there are multiple ways to get through this environment? Do you mean that I have something new that's been added to my suit? Do you mean that I'm supposed to go try something different? There's no explanation of any of that.
Well, that particular thing means put your visor down. You can see different points on your map.
It would have been nice if they explained that at some point.
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't super unclear about that, but I understand the overall point you're making of... And that's, I think, my gripe about the story is that...
Go protect this guy and help him.
There's really no need for any of that. And even the payoff at the end of all that, while superficially interesting, it bears no relevance to
90 seconds
anything.
Of introducing who the hell I was prior to putting me in the submarine and suddenly... Like, the game starts with
you're
you
as Alcatraz, dude.
Exactly. Who?
Yeah.
What? Why? Where, when, how, like nothing.
Yeah.
The fact that it's just so clean slated, I get the idea. I get where they were going for. It's like you're supposed to be coming into this and then like trying to sort out what's going on. A little frame of reference helps a lot. You know, if you go back to Fear, odd.
Yeah.
I don't know why that came to mind, but it did. Like, even though the point man was just the point man, you at least got some introductory exposition about like who he was, what team he was working with, why they were there, how they got dispatched to the docks. Like, you got enough of that so that when shit started hitting the fan, you at least had some sense of what the hell is going on.
Well,
here you're like, sell dudes, what the protect? What am I doing?
Yeah, my reference, of course, would be Homefront. I wish a little of what I loved about Homefront permeated into this game. just in a context or a storytelling perspective.
Yeah.
But everything that Homefront isn't, which is a lengthy single player experience, a very satisfying series of climaxes, small moments that are butted up against to huge moments, this game nails. And
how'd you like the gunplay? How's the gunplay?
I had a great time with the gunplay. I mean, again, there are moments that are you kind of figure out ways to game the system. For instance, you have a grab when you're up close to enemies, and you can grab them and hold their throats. The first game had that as well, then you can execute them. But you can get that grab when you're so far away from guys that I ended up just overusing that because it was an easy way to get rid of enemies, and that's a little bit of a balance problem. But it didn't take away from the fact that the gunfights on the whole, because there are just little mini arenas that you're entering, always played out differently. If I died and I had to play it out a different way, there was always a unique experience in that little setting. And maybe people might not like the fact that it's a series of those. But there are also other moments where you just have to like run and... it's a game where you don't have to kill every enemy in your path. I mean, there were whole sequences where I was like, I'm just going by these people and these aliens. And there's so many different kinds of experiences because you are in small, cramped spaces and you're in big, huge outdoor environments. It's a very impressive single-player campaign that I don't think they compromised on. I think a lot of games, I would think Homefront is an example, again, of that, where... to get the game out, I think they probably truncated the experience. And it doesn't feel like this game had any of that. It feels so big and such great ideas on display that they went full bore on.
So you sunk a lot of time into single player. Obviously, next week you think we'll be talking about multiplayer? Or do you think multiplayer is going to be a contender when we come back next week?
I don't know. I'm not a multiplayer enthusiast. Mm-hmm. and this game in multiplayer doesn't seems super fun. I haven't heard a lot of great things about it, but I can't recommend the single player highly enough. I'm really impressed with
it. Well, I got a copy of it today. I'll be giving it a whirl, and we will probably revisit it some more because I'm really curious to have my experience and then like see how well it meshes with what you're talking about. All right, folks, already through all kinds of games, and we still have a lot more still to come, including David Ruffin Jr. with All My Life. And as a quick reminder, if you can, go by playforjapan.org, where you can bid on many charitable auctions, including a chance to come check out the Weekend Confirmed show, where you could be sitting with us during breaks, just like this one. My guilty pleasure is still half a bottle of Jameson.
And it looks like a blurry mess.
Awesome.
Half a bottle of Jameson. Douche crumpet. Douche. Awesome. Douche crumpet. Half a bottle of Jameson.
I'll give you a couple of concrete examples. Oh, I just want to have another few minutes with it.
I always feel awkward doing it on a plane.
It's so sexy.
There's like boobs or something like that. Like
half a bottle of Jameson.
Right, your eyes are putting two images together.
Did you find it as satisfying in the smaller size?
It's amazing to me how much I will forgive for what it gives me, because what it gives me is so rare. Oh, I just want to have another few minutes with it.
This will be where the Jeff and Jeffs compare notes on who they've taken to bed.
I always feel awkward doing it on a plane, like some crazy sex scene, and there's this old lady sitting next to me. I'm like, kind of shit.
Well, you should get a Mile High achievement.
Rich storytelling.
Yeah, it looked like old scrambled Skinamax. Right, your eyes are putting two images together.
Why are you such a douche crumpet?
I'll give you a couple of concrete examples.
Douche crumpet. Douche crumpet. Half a bottle of Jameson.
It's funny, because it's one of those games that I think about when I'm not playing it.
Awesome. That was awesome.
That was awesome. Out of context.
And fantastic.
I love it.
Hey, if you guys will indulge me for just a moment, actually, you're going to have to indulge me in news too, because I will probably go crazy over Code Veronica getting a HD remake later this year, because I'm pretty excited about that.
Because you're a big fan of Code Veronica.
Best Resident Evil game, of at least my favorite Resident Evil game. Quick indulgent, though. A lot of people have asked if we were going to cover Test Drive Unlimited 2, and after my limited experience with it, no.
That's too bad.
Because I really just would not take any delight in throwing it under the bus. Mm. Test Drive Unlimited was one of my really like awesome early Xbox dark horses, sleepers, whatever you want to call them, and it's just a massive disappointment. It's in so many regards that... You know, I saw a few people posted that it's more good than it, more fun than it is good. Yeah, it's you can't get to the fun because it's not good in so many ways. So unfortunately, sorry. But we will be doing Shift 2, which I hopefully will have for this weekend. So maybe we'll have some Shift 2 next week. All right.
I love those guys that made Shift 2. They're awesome.
The old Simbin guys. What's the name of their new outfit? I can't think of it. Simbin was in my head. Anyway, yeah, they do a great job. And Soderstrom being a racer, like that EA guy, like they're super into it. I'm really hoping that the racing is good in that. I love car games. I love Gran Turismo. But I especially love a game where like the racing gets right. Like, I loved Race Driver games. Those were like Cody's Race Driver games were so good. Anyway, let's kick this off with we've talked a little bit about franchises branching out and doing, you know, Facebook and iPad and all kinds of tie-in games. Bailey AU jumped in here and said, similar to Jeff Kanata, I'm not as excited for those types of experiences, those ones where it's the same game being accessed through different devices, as I am for the promise of different yet connected experiences on differing devices. What franchises do you think could implement these? And are we, as traditional gamers, guilty of labeling efforts by developers to do this as a simple cash grab?
Well, I think, sometimes it'll smell like a cash grab when it is. And oftentimes, if you have an experience that is worthwhile, then it doesn't feel so much like a cash grab. You know what I'm saying?
I think you should re-explain that because that actually didn't work for me.
I think you can sense when the experience was thrown together and they're looking for a way people certainly love Master Chief, let's put him in pink tutu and throw him in the old Dance Central game or whatever.
One's a cynical way to make money, the other one's actually you're making something you want to make.
Thank you for translating my nonsense.
No, that's all right.
But I think maybe an example, and it doesn't get to like the Facebook game, but Star Fox on GameCube. I'm blanking on the name. I could look it up because I have my
Star Fox Adventures.
The Zelda knockoff.
Well, it wasn't exactly a Zelda knockoff, but yeah.
But that type of game where that game wasn't built as a Star Fox game, and then through development they were like, well, let's put Fox in this and it can sell. Like, is that a cash grab?
I thought the game was awesome.
It was well done, but would you have played it if it was called, you know, Dinosaur Land Adventures?
I love dinosaurs.
So yes, you would have.
Did you play it when it was called Jet Force Gemini?
Mm-mm.
No. I mean, obviously not exactly the same, but you know, I see what you're saying. So like, I think that kind of digresses off of what Bailey was getting at. And I think that, Bailey, the answer, at least for me, is that I think that there's really a great opportunity to be creative here, because we can all say, oh, well, obviously, if you have like a role-playing game, you could work on your character progression. If you have a racing game, you could play with your car. If you have an adventure game, you could work on your skill trees. But I think it'll be more interesting to see what sort of extensions of in-game systems can be then lifted into other experiences, you know. And so I'm trying, that's an abstract answer, so I'm trying to think of a great example of it, but I would think that you need a game, maybe like a sandbox game, maybe like an Assassin's Creed. Like, what if they somehow took out the assignment of assassinations out of Assassin's Creed and turned that into a Facebook game that you played socially with your friends who are also playing Assassin's Creed, and all of that data then came back into your Assassin's Creed game when you were playing it?
Like Assassin's Mafia Creed Wars thing. Like, I mean, that's basically what it would
be. Something like that. I think that if you started to think about like things like that, that those would be the things that would get me pulled into doing it. You know, playing a Romeville clone or whatever. Like, no, I'm not really going to be that interested in that. That would be totally come off as a cash grab. But again, I think that's also why, you know, you see companies like Insomniac looking at what they can do with it, is because you're going to start seeing people making real games in that space, and that'll be nice because there's so much disdain for So Hard What's in There. I mean, that's why I want to talk about the Naked Gun game later, is because it's cool to see an adventure, you know, someone saying, well, we're going to make an adventure game and we're going to do it in a social space.
I think those games that have true connectivity that's required to make the game work and function well, you run a risk of limiting your audience, though. It's like making a Kinect-only game where, so I want to play this game, I love Assassin's Creed Wars, whatever, but it's like, I'm not going to do the Facebook interview. So, you know what I mean? Like, everybody needs to have every part to get the quote-unquote full game experience.
I don't know. Maybe the part of the – I mean, if we're going to expand on that Assassin's Creed Wars game on Facebook, what if your friends who didn't play Assassins became like the wild cards that you hired in as like mercenaries to augment your team? and you started to get into battles with everybody else, like who could hire the better mercenary team? And what if Jeff would became, what if there was like a bidding war, then like we're all friends with Jeff, but Jeff can only be purchased into one of our assassin teams because he's not playing Assassin's Creed, but he's like a mercenary for hire. And we're all trying to figure out like what the best way is to get him to come work for our mercenary team.
You better get a check when they make this. That's what that sounds awesome.
It does sound awesome, yeah. Actually.
All right, anyway, so I think there's lots of cool ideas like that, like looking at the systems that you have inside your game and pulling and then saying, what can we do with this game system that would then could take to other places? And some of them will be portables, and some of them will be on pad, and some will be on social networks.
Or like I'm playing Torchlight, and I have the game where I play just as the pet, my pet in Torchlight, and I
there you
like,
go.
Level up my pet in my Torchlight pet adventure.
Exactly. I'd totally do that.
Yeah.
And I think that these sorts of experiences are the things that will help really maintain and not take away from the, you know, premium full-sized boxed game experience that we all really like. CJ Stronghammer talks about the price of game versus length. He says, for me, the length of a game doesn't matter as much as if it is well-made and an enjoyable experience. Portal is a prime example. I gladly pay $60 for Portal because it's such a fun and well-made game, even though it's shorter than some. Quite often, I hear people say that because a game is short, then it should be cheaper. But does that then mean that a longer game would be more expensive? So, for instance, would Dragon Age be an $80 or a $90 game because it's 70 hours plus? I think the biggest problem that some games like Homefront have is that even if they should be cheaper, they price themselves lower from the get-go, and then people think that they're crap because they're $40. I think what we need to have happen is to break this trend is a $60 game that brings in an era of really variable pricing for being a big blockbuster release, something that people know is going to be good, like Gears 3 or Uncharted 3, and then to launch at $40. All right, so we've talked
about... Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Exactly. We've talked about that a bunch of times, CJ, yeah. And the problem is there's no pressure for that to happen.
Right, right.
It's not the length of the game. It's the motion of the ocean.
But I thought the point that he made in the middle was very interesting about should a Dragon Age be $80 or $90 because it's a 70-hour experience?
No. No, it shouldn't. No, also because there's three locations in Dragon Age. So if it's a per location fee.
now the truth comes out. You're giving him hell for that.
I think you run into problems with that equation. Like just equating length to value is a problem. I mean, you need way more information than that. So, for example, you know, I remember when Max Payne came, the first Max Payne came out, it was like six or seven hours to get through the whole thing. Yeah. And I loved that game.
Yeah.
Like back when it came out.
I did love that game.
I was like, bullet time, you know, I played through it a few times and I was like, okay, $60, no problem. Or $50 at whatever it was at the time.
Crunch, 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 crunch.
Right.
Variable pricing.
No, crunch, crunch, crunch when he like eats the steroids.
Oh, right,
to, like,
right. Yes, he's always the pain pills.
Always on the pain pills.
Right.
I mean, it goes other ways. There's some system of it in place in Japan, but it's based on popularity, not on length. I mean, when Metal Gear comes out or Final Fantasy comes out, it's always, you know, at least a couple hundred or a thousand yen more than run-of-the-mill game. And and so I think you run it, if you open up the door of variable pricing, it's like, why would it be tied to length? I mean, these are companies. They're maximizing profits. So if you can charge more for a game, they will. If they think they need to charge less, you know.
But it's not, while it might not be a one-to-one corollary between length of game and size and cost of development, it is oftentimes reflective of that. I mean, building a game like Dragon Age, especially Origins, like the amount of team time and man hours that went into that was monumental. I would say that, you know, like of all the $60 box games that are out there, they had to be in the top like 5% or so as far as development costs. Whereas, you know, another game that's like, so there's where the problem comes. Like then at the other end of the spectrum, there's probably a $60 game that cost could it be so low as a 10% of that? I mean, like there are $60 games that probably didn't cost a whole lot to make. We saw a couple of moves, and we saw Majin come in at $40. Right. That was a smart move. I mean, obviously, it wasn't marketed very well, and you know, Konami just didn't have the oomph behind it to make it sell. I think there's a great opportunity here still. I think there's a huge open door for a middle price game, but you can't have a Dragon Age come down.
And I think part of it too is nobody wants to make a game that they're planning to be a AAA title and then get to the end of the road and be like, oh yeah, we could sell this for $40 instead.
Right.
But on the other hand, I think that there are people that get to the end of that road where they have a completed product and they're like, you know, we could probably sell 25% more units if we just cut the price down to, you know what
Maybe.
I mean? I just don't think there's that thinking going on at the end of the, like, they're already committed to this is how we're going to release this game. This is what it's meant to be when they're, you know, earlier on in the process.
Or open the door to doing a AAA home front length single player without multiplayer for $30 or $40.
Sure.
I mean, and I'm not saying, and maybe home front's not the best example, but I think people think of it in length terms. But I mean, what if, you know, what if that was, or like, how long is Crysis?
I think it's like 10-12 hours for.
Okay, so
it's a series, you know.
Imagine a game of Crysis's ilk, half as long as it was, put together in a reasonable amount of time with a reasonable team, and sell that for $40. Would you buy it?
Well, yeah.
I mean, I'm getting to a point where I would like that because that pile of shame thing really working against me all the time.
I mean, from a consumer advocacy point of view, I'm always going to say yes, I want less expensive games, but the reality of the situation is that the perception is a $40 game is of less value than a $60 game.
But would you, how about this? Would you rather have in that world, would you rather have 3 $40 games that you finished and had a great time with, or 2 $60 games, one of which you may not even have the time to finish, and the other one you finished but it wound up taking a tremendous amount of time?
But that's not my choice to make, unfortunately, you know. I think a lot of people make that exact choice. Actually, I'm to contradict myself. I think people make that exact choice by saying, I will wait until the price drops on game X so that I can get 3 games instead of the 2 on day one.
That's where I think I'm a fan of owning my media still. I'm a little old like that. But I like – this is where digital distribution can come in, because I think the problem you get with these price points is, I mean, if a game comes out at 60, the buyers purchased it at a price in which they thought they need to sell it at 60 to make their margin. But I mean, I think there's – what Steam does, where a game comes out and they put it on sale for a weekend, and you can just move the price so much quicker and so much easier when you're not dealing with boxed retail channels. Mm-hmm.
But keep in mind, Steam and digital distributors are still in a sort of like, we also want to capture market share. So they do some crazy loss leader stuff to get people in the door. A lot of the success of a game is oftentimes predicated on its reviews, as we saw at Homefront. We had a big discussion last week, which sparked a lot of people talking about reviews. And Eternal Gamer 2 had a lot to say about this. And you know, there was some, I'm just going to leave the other part on the table. I'm going to lift out this part. Says, in other mediums, critics attempt to be tastemakers and trendsetters, but it feels like in the gaming media, writers are far too comfortable being passive conduits of big budget hype and popular bandwagons. And I feel like I've heard, like, I do feel like there's a perception, an undercurrent perception of that out there. What do you guys think about that? How prevalent is it? How much do you perceive when you're reading, you know, reviews that you're reading publisher hype or people falling prey to that?
I take issue with the premise. I don't think people
because,
talk about
and I will put you. I want to put you on the spot now. That I think about it. Your Crysis review that we talked about, like, were your conscious comments very glowing?
Yeah,
and a lot of the exciting stuff that is, you know, unfortunately would be referred back of the box stuff.
Okay, I'm only speaking honestly about how I felt about the game.
I know you are. I'm giving you an opportunity to reply and respond.
Sure. I think that a lot of people talk about games press or criticism as one thing, as, you know, in just a general blanket statement. I know a lot of people, just reading comments and talkbacks about our show, say things like, you guys felt X or whatever. And I go, you know what? There's 3 or 4 different voices on this show, and almost always we disagree.
Yeah,
you know, and to throw out a blanket statement about, well, you guys felt this or the gaming intelligentsia or whatever. There may be it may feel like there's a common wisdom, but you know, when people agree that stuff, that good stuff is good, I don't doubt they have honest feelings about that. And when I have criticisms about things that a lot of people love. You and I got in a huge argument several years ago about Mass Effect, the first Mass Effect, because I had huge issues with that game, right? There are...
We did indeed.
Right. There are different voices and nuanced opinions, I think, and to say that all of game criticism feels one way about something... But if you look at a game like Gears of War, like the first Gears of War, it's very difficult to look at that game and go, you know, this isn't a great experience. You know, as video gamers, there are a lot of things that we can all agree on. And I think a lot of us in this, you know, that have a voice in this space –
come from a very common background. And if you're looking for, you know, a contradictory point of view, if you're looking for people to say, you know, I don't like this kind of experience, it's probably because they come from a different background. Because
let me try and interject. I think we may have drifted a little bit. I think one of the points Eternal was trying to make is that he or she feels that movie critics are not as readily accepting of the Hollywood blockbuster as a, air quote, great movie, and look for the king's speeches of the world and then try to champion them and bring them out.
You don't think we do that? You don't think I've been shouting from the mountaintops about the Braids and the Limbos of the world and the heavy rains? How many times have I brought up Heavy Rain on this show? You know what I mean? Yes, I think our industry is much more dominated by the quote unquote blockbuster mentality than say movies or books or other media. But that's just because our industry is younger than those.
I agree.
And so, you know, there's a lot of fun to be had in these blockbuster experiences. And I always try to remind myself that this is about having fun. But yeah, I mean, I'm going to point out flaws if I believe they're flaws. You know, I loved the experience of playing Crysis 2, but I recognize that the storytelling in that game is crappy.
I think that a portion of it can be attributed to there's a lot of mentality in game review that comes from you know, the history of where games came from, them being more of like software products and being reviewed more like products, and it's taken a while for us to evolve how we handle a more critical and critiquing eye. I mean, that's something that I don't want to sound like I'm blowing my own horn, but that's something that I've obviously, you know, really been hot for, especially in the way we do our reviews. I mean, Jeff knows that I talk a lot about this to the edit team about, like, you know, not doing a manual to the game, not doing a product guide.
Right,
not
a book report.
Not doing a book report. It's like, but then at the same time, like, there's a large number of people out there who basically want some doctor to come in and do like a colonoscopy on the game and like pull all the shit out of the middle of it and like really dig through there and get all the bad parts. And I just don't know.
Let me say something specifically to that, because it's something I've felt for a while and I never really voiced it before. But I think that there is a perception that among some really intense hardcore fans that there needs to be this slant in games, quote unquote games journalism, and I don't consider myself a games journalist, but in the grand scheme of games journalism, that has to be like you're covering politics, you know, where you come in skeptical and negative and attacking, and that they have to prove to you that something is good. And then that may be healthy in a certain respect, and it's certainly healthy when dealing with government and other areas, but this is a hobby for all of us. It happens to be our work as well, but it's something we enjoy. And I think going in wanting things to be good, looking for the enjoyment out of that, I don't think that's a bad thing. And I think the pendulum's swinging too far to the other direction, where people are just looking for things to criticize is not healthy either.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Oh, I was just going to say, I agree with what you said, Jeff, by and large. I do think that there is a certain element of stuff that you wouldn't see in Hollywood. Like, critics will get invited to screenings and stuff, but you don't hear of, like, a bunch of critics being put on a C-14 and flown out to some sequestered location for 2 days to watch a film.
Well, that happens.
Actually,
friends that do that all the time.
Okay.
Well, there are a number of screenings that actually take place in pretty crazy locations.
Oh, yeah. Or set visits, or hobnobbing with the director because you got access and other people didn't. That happens all the time.
Okay. So that it does. But in both of those instances, there are probably people that, movie critics and game critics, that are affected by that experience in some way.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to look at any review on a case-by-case basis, regardless of what it is. And, you know, you can sort of tell if it feels like somebody's, you know, tooting somebody else's marketing line. But, you know, I think that it's quite possible that people are at least have to be aware of the fact that when they're given special treatment like that and being put into an environment to view a piece of art or a product that, you know, is not in the normal landscape of things, it's not out in the real world,
you know, you might come away with some different
You better turn on your
conceptions.
Filters.
Yeah,
I agree with that. Exactly. You better turn on your filters. You better have that in consideration.
I think part of it is, for the most part now in our industry, people that review games are fans of games, and that's why they got into it. Whereas in the movie industry, film critics, a lot of them went to film school or, you know, studied film and they're coming from it from a different angle necessarily than, because we are a younger industry where people come in and you're seeing more like TRS, you guys, I think, review films as, you know, fans of movies. A good buddy of mine, a comedian, Mark Ellis, he does, I think it's Schmoes No, where it's like, you know, common guy reviews. But for the most part, we're gamers. So it's like, I'm playing Crysis 2. Yeah, fuck yeah, we're excited about playing Crysis 2. You know, I didn't go to, you know, video game school and learn and say, well, the cuts between this. And it's a different art.
I think what you're talking about even more than that is the internet. And it's
the what now?
It's a series of tubes.
Because even the way you just characterized film criticism has changed. Because that used to be the way it was when there was a closed system. When in order to get a published film review,
right,
you need to be published. Nowadays, any human being can publish their view on anything at any time, all the time.
I've registered JeffCanadaFilmReviews.com, and I publish my reviews there.
I think that's very wise of you. But now it's an open system, and you find that even some of the most popular, well-respected reviewers of any kind of medium have no formal training and just have a following on the internet. And I don't think that's a problem. I think that there's a place for all of that. I think there's a place for scholastic and real hard hitting analysis of things. But I don't think that, you know, looking at any kind of media from a enthusiastic point of view is necessarily detrimental to the industry. I really don't.
I think that, it's interesting you brought up film school. I would also say, though, that a lot of popular movie critics do approach movie critiquing from a familiar and friendly and fun sort of approach. For instance, although you liked Battle for LA, I really, really enjoyed Roger Ebert's review of it. Not for even the movie, but for the fact that it was he went a little too far, I think, but it was a funny column. It was almost like a funny column.
Yeah.
It was not almost like
super hyperbolic, but very, very, very funny.
It was almost like reading a comedic editorial more than a review, because I think he got to the point where he was like, well, it doesn't even deserve to be reviewed. But anyway, now that I have you guys thinking at a high level, that you're going to like this one. Ellis Kim over on NeoGAF brought a really interesting thread into last week's show. He's working on a paper on behavioralism and found an article on Slate that involves MIT professor Laura Schultz and her graduate student Elizabeth Bonowitz. And they are looking at how four-year-olds learn with a new toy that's comprised of four tubes. And there's a little more detail if you want to go back to the...
The internet?
It's a series of tubes.
A little bit more detail if you want to go back to last week's show thread on NeoGAF. But the crux of what he pulled out is that the MIT study was finding that direct instruction made children less curious and less likely to discover new information. Let me translate that now. So Ellison says, I'm not calling Mr. Canado a four-year-old, but when I was reading this, I was most...
That's a great opener.
I was most definitely reminded of his discussion about discovering his other options in Dragon Age 2 and his seemingly conflicted but ultimately optimistic outlook at how the designers made that particular instance with the guards. With a lot of games, we're stuck with rigid frameworks to play in, condensing into what often becomes formulaic or polished gameplay. Smooth machinery is something to be appreciated, but should that reliable yet predictable machinery be the core gameplay? Gentlemen, Jeff, Mr. Mattis, you're playing a game that really typifies all of those core mechanics, being really polished, all those things.
Mm-hmm.
Play devil's advocate with yourself for a minute. What could it be if, instead of knowing how to do all those things, it pushed you to be an actual discoverer instead of a figurative discoverer?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, because there's a lot of it's more of being a learner of the game systems than an actual explorer, although it does a pretty good job of making you feel like you're exploring Japan. Wow, that's a pretty good question. honestly, I mean, with Shogun, there is a certain degree of, you know, they made this game based on 7 years of experience making these games, and they've refined all these gameplay systems, and it's super intricate and stuff. But as a result, you know, there's a level of accessibility that's just not there. And it doesn't really, it encourages you to explore, but it encouraged me to explore the encyclopedia that comes with the game as much as it encouraged me to actually play.
Did a kid with Air Jordan show up to sell you that encyclopedia? That's an Encyclopedia Britannica reference that no one gets, but that's okay. He always had Air Jordans.
Wait, quick, somebody make an Encyclopedia Brown joke. Okay.
I think it stems, I'm sorry, from the gamer's fear of failing, where like we don't want to explore because it's like, well, is that or also gamers traditionally have this, I want to see everything. Oh, you beat a game? Well, did you get 1,000 gamer score? Because that's beating the game. Where, you know, if you give this exploration option and let them figure out their own things, people are hesitant to do that. Gamers are, I feel, hesitant to do that because we want to do the right thing. And where I fall in is I want to progress the story, which is where my stuff with Red Dead came in, where I could explore, but I'm like, well, I'm going to go do this now. And we're giving them the options to do whatever. Like, how big of a sandbox do you have where gamers feel like they're still getting the full experience versus, you know...
Yeah, I don't even know if we can do it yet, because part like what you're saying about Red Dead, the problem becomes all of those things that you would go do in Red Dead would be those polished systems that you're familiar with, so you can't really break that wall. It's really tough to get to that emergent gameplay thing. It's like I'm starting to think about, like, you know, like a great example to me of emergent gameplay was just the modes that people came up with, for instance, in Project Gotham, of doing like the cat and mouse game. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't included in the game and people started playing it because it worked with the tools they were given.
Or like the initial Halo races that people did.
Exactly.
That they turned into an actual, yeah.
Two things. First of all,
and that's real discovery.
Isn't the experience of playing Portal or Limbo exactly what we're talking about?
I don't know about Portal. Portal still, like, it teaches you a system and then it can polishes but on. I don't know.
I'm not at my tier. It's almost a false sense of discovery because your discovery is planned, but it requires you to meet it halfway and do the things required that make you go, oh, if I fall through the portal enough times, I get momentum and then I propel and
But you and a friend would have the exact same story about that experience playing that game because it's a linear, you know, you didn't discover this and go, oh, dude, you know, that's what I found. Yeah.
So then the other argument I would make is Minecraft.
That's a good one.
Right?
That's a very good one because here it is. The more you poke and fiddle around with it, the more you figure out what you can do with it, which drives you to poke and fiddle around with it more because then you can do more stuff with it.
But that is a true sandbox in that the game is only the sand. We're just providing you the building blocks of game and you make it what you want it to be. So that is, I think, not enough structure, at least for me, to find, you know.
There's probably just not a lot of people. I mean, I think that this, like what we're getting to here especially, is the core of really high-level concepts that really, really, like, the genius game designers of our era are thinking about all the time. Like, like this is the kind of things that they're thinking about of, like, how do I keep the player off their guard just enough that they're thinking and go ahead.
The obvious one that we all missed, The Sims.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Sims is a great one because it doesn't, like, there are a number of systems. Like, it's not saying eliminate systems because there still have to be. I mean, there's obviously the toy that the children are playing with in this MIT test still has systems to it.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of they're not telling you, like, if they tell you, Jeff, you can do this, this, and this, then you know you can do those things. If you go and discover them, then you think, well, what else might I be able to do?
Yeah. And you see as The Sims developed, as the sequel came out, and they built in things based on what they saw people doing with the first game. Like, oh, people were telling their stories. So now we have this photo mechanic because people were just taking screenshots and putting captions. Now we built that into the game because that's what people were doing.
But the funny
thing
is that then is where the complacency starts to build in because now you know how that system works. And so instead of you discovering it, you're like, oh, of course I know how this works because I've done it before. It's a very interesting logic or like creativity question. So that's an excellent question. I would love to explore that some more. That would be a great one to talk about in the comments section on shacknews.com, which is where you can always participate in the show. And yes, we obviously watch the NeoGAF too. We love all you guys. And I have to say that one thing about last week's show that was really really gave me a big shot in the arm was how many people supported us. How many people said, like, we really love your show. There were so many great notes just of, like, I was like,
of the year anniversary.
It
was very great
and well earned.
Thanks. And one thing that came up a lot in that was, how can we help support the show? How can we make sure that stays on? You know, I'm staunchly opposed to ever having to charge a subscription fee or any of that kind of stuff. And it's really not.
But if you send checks directly to our house,
yeah,
I don't really
individually.
Like, they will be cashed.
We didn't go down that because someone asked about that. It's really not your problem as a listener to figure out how to keep us in business. That's our problem or whatever. But I would say this is like, the one thing is, you know, we are here because you listen. And so if you really like the show, share it with your friends. And word of mouth is always great. And I mean,
yeah,
I will say it. I hate to say it because it makes me feel like a shill. But I mean, you know, if you like the show and could review it on iTunes, that would be really nice.
iTunes. Give it 4 stars. You love it. It's a great show. Do what should be done.
Wait, 4 stars instead of 5?
5 stars. Max stars. Give it 5 stars. I'm on a 4 stars.
Give it like 3.5 solid stars.
Anyway,
because we don't want to brag.
Yeah, I don't really like the shill, but
give it a modest rating.
Who's a douche crumpet now? 5 stars. Give it 5 stars.
So yeah, listen, enjoy the show, and like, don't worry, we'll do our best to keep it going. And right now, if I can find my break notes, here they are, right here. This is, and of course, we would love to get more music. Submit it to Del Rio through Shack News, Facebook, or SoundCloud. Right now, this is David Ruffin Jr. with All My Life.
Something to prove, so I brush my teeth with a melody and wash my face with the brew. Oh yeah, and make my way to the kitchen to get a kiss from my love. Stop and pray, cause I'm grateful and know it came from above. Open up my window to brighten in my life. It warms me up inside all day and into the night. Can you see how things are going my way, and I feel that I'm so blessed today, yeah. Expected from me. Open up my window and connect with the night. Cause it's a little easier to dream if you can take flight. If you dream that things are going your way, then when you wake up in the morning, you'll be able to see.
Beautiful sounds of All My Life from David Ruffin Jr. And that was really stepping it up in the music department. So there you go. Now we're dropping bombs up in Weekend Confirm. Unlike that dastardly awful thing that Christian made us listen to again.
I've officially submitted Friday for a music break.
Front page, the news on. Anyway, we have
it's
our
the weekend.
I would say this. You know what? Our news preparatory jingle is better than Friday.
That is not saying much.
True, but also true.
Let's hear it.
News, bitch.
It's so funny. Like, people are like, that's really cool, but what's with the news bitch at the end?
What's that? I think I was here for that. Is that my bitch? Am I dropping bombs?
That
I'm
is
dropping bombs
that
on
is
that
Christian's
mofo.
Bitch right up in
Christian,
there.
Classing up the joint.
You're right. It is way better than Friday.
Like, see? There's actual harmonizing and shit going on up in there.
I wouldn't go too far.
All right. So let's get her started on the news. We got a lot of news to get through. If you are picking up a 3DS this weekend, you'll want to immediately get set up on the internet and download your system update. Yes, friends and neighbors, Nintendo has now entered the era of we're going to push system updates all the time. This system update will get you an OK Go video in 3D.
Sweet.
I'm not kidding you.
I gotta do that when I get home.
You'll get the video to White Knuckles. You can watch it. I already downloaded it. It's we already got it. You get the 3D video to White Knuckles by OK Go and enhancements to the communication features of the 3DS.
Sweet.
Whatever the hell that means, because it already communicates.
Probably means just bug fixes.
It probably means that they're already starting to do the proactive changing of code to head off hackers. That's my opinion. And I think you'll probably see them update fairly frequently because they've been stung and now they've got a system where they don't have to worry about it. I guess they'll distribute them on carts also to make sure that non-wired, non-connected folks.
How long was the update?
It went by pretty quickly. It was faster than the PS3 to update, so maybe...
That's also not saying much.
Yeah.
That PS3 isn't that bad. Come on, it takes like 2 minutes.
I'm going to guess
maybe like a minute
could
and a half.
Could you pick what you wanted? Or like, could you have to wait for it to get this OK Go video? You know what I mean? Or could you just get the necessary
stuff?
The
OK Go video is rolled into the update, which is kind of funky, and it becomes a new icon on your menu screen. Like,
really?
Yeah, the OK Go video is... Yeah, I know, it's really weird. Like, so right down here at the bottom, it's like you go swirl over to the left, pass all this stuff, and oh, look, here's the White Knuckles OK Go video.
It's a little ad box on your...
Yeah, not to hate, but can you get rid of that?
I can open it.
Oh, well, I'm sure they would approve.
I can open it and
that's
watch
the
it.
The same thing as getting rid of it.
I'm
pretty sure.
You know, you guys just opened the thought pattern to a really insidious thing. Do you think they'll embed like paid? That's not how they're going to do the movie trailers and shit, is it?
Well, I mean, Xbox has it on Live where you know, there's ad buys when they updated to Silverlight running on your dashboard. And is it front and center or is it kind of
It's just one of the menu. The icons all line up across the bottom. It's the far left-hand one.
Did you download the White Knuckles update to your system?
Yeah, it's awesome.
No, I downloaded the Friday update, but I haven't gotten the White Knuckles yet.
After that, my DS went on strike and said, I'm not playing anymore. Actually, the next one is interesting because my video question of the week, and if you're not watching already, we have the Weekend Confirmed channel rocking, and Dave has actually been working, and we're going to have a iTunes video feed, hopefully this week, if not this week, though, the next week, with our pre-show video and our questions of the week for everyone who appears each week, was about this very subject, which is that an amateur programmer, or maybe he's not amateur, a programmer, his name is... I'm probably going to mess this up. Shantanu Goel came up with a hack to attach the Kinect sensor to a PlayStation 3 and use it as a control interface. It's a cool video. This came to us through the site PS Groove. We also have the video on Shack News. Basically, he does this through a PC running Linux and then transmits it into the PS3 via Bluetooth.
Wow.
So, like, he's really come up with a really cool, like, set of interpretation to make this thing happen. If you watch the video, he uses it to navigate the cross-media bar, and then he eventually gets into Killzone. Obviously, not much he can do movement-wise, but he's able to look around and some other stuff. It's a cool proof-of-concept thing. Microsoft actually plans to launch an official SDK for the Kinect for Windows this spring, and Sony is bringing its motion controller, the Move, to PC through a toolkit called Move Me, although that has to be run through a PS3. What do you guys think of all this weirdness?
I think it's fantastic. I think it is the key to the fact that, we have Kinect, it's a huge success. There's enough
out there, that it's got people's interest. Mm-hmm. It is a worthwhile time investment for in developers, and it's a worthwhile time investment for the amateur innovator to really take the device and do some stuff that doesn't necessarily make financial sense for a lot of these companies to do, but could be so cool and really push the technology into places that then could be picked up and given a a full-fledged
It's a cool extension. I mean, obviously, of the PC world, it's been really, you know, there's been a lot of folks already fiddling around with, well, I can hook this connect up to my computer. What can I do with it?
Oh, yeah. There's so many awesome YouTube videos of people doing weird and wacky stuff with it. It's great.
I heard the music video Friday was shot entirely.
Oh, good God.
I mean, anytime you get enthusiasts or people experimenting with things like that, like you said, Jeff, that maybe aren't doing it for the money, but they're just playing with the tech to see what they can do, you're going to get good things out of it. I mean, not an example of a peripheral or tech, but I mean, Portal was a student project from kids at DigiPen exploring game mechanics, and it became awesome. And I think you'll see a lot of the cool stuff some of the PC hacks are doing that are utilizing more of the tracker where the Kinect can move and follow you, utilizing that. The giving move.
Funny you should bring that up. Someone actually brought up in the We Can Confirm thread about how innovative and we're not paying enough attention to head tracking technology.
Yeah, and you have people doing that. The move.me stuff, get that in the hands of the people and see what they can do. And you know, you can build your computer interface. You have to have your PS3 on for it. But there's so much potential there that Sony and Microsoft maybe aren't going to put the risk out for. But I mean, imagine a game like Minecraft where it's a big sandbox, but you're playing with your hands, or you're sticking your hands into the radiation research lab tool that you see in science. You know, they put their hands in the gloves and you get to manipulate the thing. That sounds awesome.
It sounds cool.
Like a lot of fun.
What was the name of that dude that did all those awesome Wii videos? Remember the guy who did all the cool like head tracking stuff with
where he had the Wii Wiimote on his head or whatever?
Yeah.
I don't know, but that was cool.
He was rad.
Yeah. You should YouTube those also because those are really cool.
Really cool.
I am excited because this fall, Capcom is dropping two HD remakes on us for the Resident Evil series. And this is interesting because, you know, this past week, actually, the Tomb Raider trilogy came out, which if you haven't checked it out, the Tomb Raider trilogy has remastered HD versions of Anniversary, and they have like these side-by-side pictures of them. And we got the same thing early on from Capcom here, which I don't remember Resident Evil 4 looking quite so fuzzy and furry as it does in those comparison shots. But then I thought, well, you know, that was GameCube, which means that, I mean, it was standard def television. So maybe I just fondly remember it too much.
We didn't really talk about BG&E, but
no, we didn't yet.
Right. The HD version of BG&E came out a couple weeks ago now.
Christian played it.
I played it.
I've been diving in. It looks great. For taking a game where I know the polygon count is the same, and in terms of just updating the textures and graphics and putting spit and polish on a game.
And like crazy anti-aliasing passes.
Yeah. It looks really, really good.
Have you had any problems with freezing? Billy was telling me he's had some problems with it locking up on him.
I'm 5 hours in. I haven't had any crashes or anything like that. It's been really smooth.
Same game, plays great.
The only wonky thing is the camera, because now you got twin sticks, and it really wasn't built for that, and the camera can be a little frustrating for me.
Well, that's the problem for me, is it's notoriously been on my pile of shame, so this is a first experience, and I can see why everybody loved it, but I don't necessarily love it. I think that's a hard part with classic games, is that the genre moves forward so much that it's like, this is great, but would my time be better spent on, you know, I don't know, Twilight Princess is old now too, but, you know, whatever the next thing is that took these ideas and improved upon them further. I plan on finishing it, but it feels old, the gameplay.
And as you guys all know, my sensibilities for gaming, a huge part of the appeal to BG&E is its characters, and I just love the world and the characters, and that holds enough appeal to me that if I didn't have so many things backed up and hadn't played it originally, I would probably go back and do it.
Well, I think that's why there's still so many people, you know, rabid for a sequel. You know,
absolutely.
You know, I mean, this much later after the first game, I mean, everybody still, you know, remembers that game very fondly.
And for me, maybe I'm shallow. But for me, just having smooth, nice-looking polygons, crisp edges is enough. It's enough for me. It doesn't
actually digging out those old systems and putting them in onto my new HD TV, it would feel like, ugh. But just that HD, just one single pass of that HD is enough for me to replay
on some
those.
Games, I can certainly understand that. And I can tell you what, Code Veronica, as we talked, as you know, I teased earlier in the show, like, I am so excited to play Code Veronica again, because I think that, like, first of all, I love the Umbrella story arc from Resident Evil in the first place. It's cheesy and silly and goofy, but I really like it. I really enjoy that part. And, and you know, 4 and 5 have picked up well after the downfall of Umbrella. And, like, it's cool. I understand that they're going on and doing other things. But to me, you know, Code Veronica was the pinnacle of that story arc and has so many good moments in it. Like, it's really...
Was Code Veronica the first one that didn't have static backgrounds?
Yeah, it was all in 3D. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was all Dreamcast.
That's why it's like the first one they can do the HD remix on, yeah.
Dreamcast Tour de Force was just
That's why
awesome.
I think a lot of people may have missed it. It just had its share of re-releases as well and got, but it
yeah,
still
and
isn't.
Actually, this is the PS2 version, because this is Code X, and the PS2 version was rough, because I mean the game had been written for Dreamcast, which was pretty much inarguably a more powerful system, and then to get it into the PS2, obviously there were some compromises I think that had to be made. There's a lot of content in there, a lot of good stuff, and also 4 is going to have the post log, which I didn't even know there was one to 4, so I guess I missed part of 4, but I played 4 originally, and I don't know that I'd go back to 4. 4 was great.
God, 4 has been put on every system imaginable.
Really? Yeah, I know, right? So take a look at the side-by-sides on Shack News, see what you think. Mass Effect 2 is getting ready to drop its final downloadable content piece. That would be the Arrival. And this is a important piece if you're really into the lore, it sounds like, because Shepard gets set out to the edge of the galaxy towards where the Reaper invasion is coming from. And this will be a real bridge builder between 2 and 3. It's going to be $7, or I guess 560 Microsoft points or BioWare points, and it'll hit on March the 29th. Are you guys into this? Are you ready for some...
It's pissing me off.
Really? It's pissing me off.
I just played through my second playthrough of Mass Effect 2 with all the other DLC, because basically I played it when it came out, and then waited for all that DLC to come out, and then played it again, and now we got the last piece, and it sounds really cool, but I think I'm done until 3 comes out. That's just the way it is.
Jeff, Christian, opinions?
I might pop it in. I don't know.
You like the Mass Effects 2.
I do like the Mass Effects 2, yeah.
I'm done. 3, bring on. I think it's great what they're doing. They've kept longevity for this game for a while. They're keeping fans interested. I'm sure it's important. I hope it's not too important, because I just know what's coming out, and I don't have time.
Yep.
Or enough interest to put away time to play.
Maybe this warrants discussion like next week in the warning. One thing I find that's very interesting for me is that as much as I loved Alan Wake and as much as I love Mass Effect and Mass Effect 2, I haven't played the DLC to any of them.
What is it? How much DLC for Alan Wake was there?
There was two full story chapters that were
freaking love that game.
I loved Alan Wake. I should play those, exactly. And then Mass Effect, especially Mass Effect 2, the DLC has been story oriented. And then obviously, then this comes out and I look at it and I go, probably not. BioWare has also cautioned its rabid fans that they should be careful of beta scams for the Old Republic. Really, this is sort of a no surprise. If people are trying to sell you or tell you they've got a hookup for you and they don't have BioWare or official BioWare in their name, and I don't mean like the spam title or something, then it's not legit.
But I got an email from a prince that said if I just give him $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
You got an email from Prince?
Community manager Allison Berryman has clarified for Game Politics that it has come to our attention that there are multiple individuals and sites claiming to sell testing accounts, beta keys, or other offers of access to our game testing program. All of these offers are false. BioWare is not issuing invites to game testing via any method other than those we outline on SWTOR.com. We must caution you that those offers are often scams designed to steal your money, credit card information, or identity. So again, anything that doesn't have a no-reply@bioware.swtor.com email is not real. If you have any question, contact BWA Community Support at bioware.com.
Don't take any wooden nickels, kids.
That's right. And I guess when we get Star Wars eventually, it's not going to have a manual at all, because In the name of environmentalism, Electronic Arts has eliminated printed manuals in their entirety. Gone. Done. No more.
When was the last time you looked at a printed manual?
That was who are you to like put me on the spot? Who do you think you are?
I think it's fine as long as they stop making sports games.
I completely. Wait, I was going to say that exact same thing. Sports games.
Do you walk to work or carry your lunch?
No. But seriously, like if you eliminate manuals, that's really the only genre of game that I will actually look into a manual for.
And it's EA.
Like
it's exactly. Not, that's so the only only kind of game that doesn't walk you through how to play it.
Time out. Right. Then let me give you the explanation. So printed manuals have become a thing of past for Electronic Arts. This is part of their global initiative, environmental initiative to reduce wastes.
And so make more money.
Well, and that's the other part. A lot of people are riled up. We'll get to that in a second also. They have reported this is going to do a 40% reduction in their printed materials and packaged goods, which I thought was funny that like getting rid of the manuals only reduces it 40%. What else the hell are they?
Like, the little slip they give you your code.
Exactly.
That you
have to put other special offers and shit are still going
to
be in there, but we're going to get rid of the manuals. And it's only going to cut 40%.
Plenty of ads.
The makeup for this, or not the makeup, but what they're doing is they're transferring to digital manuals. And all games will have full digital manuals included on the disc. You'll be able to access them at any time in the game. So you'll be able to, like, while you're playing your sports game, pull up the manual and use it as reference on screen. And then they're also going to offer
that sounds like not how I would want it to work.
So you'll be able to turn on the game. And you'll have a menu item where you can go read the manual on the screen, manual.
But not while I'm playing.
You'll also be able to pause the game if you're stuck or need a reminder and open the manual from within the game as well. So either way, you can look at it. You can read the manual if you want to off the screen, or if you're in the middle of the game and you need, like, how the hell do I do a pre-snap adjustment of my linebacker in your sports game analogy, then you can pull up that mapping. Mm. You'll also be able to go to their sports site and download PDF versions of the manuals. So there's still lots of ways to get to all that information.
Yeah, you just waste those trees at home. I don't know. I guess the big, and this wasn't even EA. This was like, you know, other companies are doing this. I got, when I was playing 2K11, NBA 2K11, mm-hmm. they have like five pages of instructions in there. And it wasn't until several days later that I realized it was only a partial instruction manual. Like they included a bunch of controls, but not all the controls. And the only way to find those controls was to go online. Hmm. So it's like, you know.
You don't need to know how to shoot.
Well, I want to go online and print the manual that is like the typical manual that's in a game. Now you print it out and it's just nothing.
Yeah. Well, it's all the disclaimer. It's all the legal disclaimers and bullshit. You're right. I mean, so Jeff, you asked me when was the last time I looked at a manual. I don't know. I mean, actually, I've gotten to the point where, especially like immersive games, I think there's no excuse for you handing me an entertainment game. Like, for instance, we talk about like an Uncharted or a Halo or something like that and making me read a manual. It's ridiculous. That's totally counterintuitive to the immersion factor. But, being able to pull it up in-game makes a lot of sense to me. And
Back in the day, manuals were like little novels that you got along with the game.
Now you only get those when you pay $80. And you get the collector's edition with the bonus artwork and storybook.
But those are all just about how we made it.
But we've gotten so much more sophisticated in the way we can incorporate teaching you how to play the game.
No, I'm not opposed to this.
If I can pull up reminders in the game, I'm happy. I do agree with Christian that it's like they're certainly motivated by how much money they're going to save. Obviously. Yeah. But I can't blast them for that because, I mean, like, they are actually going to save packing materials and packaging. And that's, how can you be anti-environmentalist? I mean,
no, I think they should do it for every game except for their sports stuff.
Yeah. You still think?
I need a freaking man. Let me, or a reference card. Yeah. Or something with the controls on it, especially nowadays the games are getting like, you know, right stick and several different modifier buttons. And it's just nuts. So.
Well, they certainly were a big part of PC gaming. On the topic of PC gaming, Deus Ex was a huge PC game, and this is an interesting development. I don't know how serious it is. A lot of the shackers were very upset about it, but we learned during our interview with the game's director that the PC version of Deus Ex Human Revolution is not being physically made, is like not being developed in-house at Eidos Montreal. They're using their PC partner, Nixxis Software. And before you go crazy, Nixxis Software has been doing the PC versions of their games for quite some time. They did Kane and Lynch 2 Dog Days. They did Tomb Raider Underworld. And they even go back all the way to doing Legacy of Kane Soul Reaver for Dreamcast. So these guys have done a lot of concurrent game development of studio projects on other platforms. So it's not like they're crazy. And And Jean-Francois Dugas is the game director, and he even says that he's playing the game currently on PC, that they're completely tied in. All the designs and changes to design are being done in Montreal and sent to them. We review the builds and give them comments. We keep up with them. It's the exact same process. It's the exact same process, except that the programmers aren't in the same office. And the primary reason is due to logistics. Simply, they don't have enough human bodies, even though Montreal is quite huge, to do all of these versions at once. Upsetting? What do you guys think?
I'm totally fine with it, unless they ship a subpar product. I mean,
yeah,
I'm good with it.
You guys are easy.
Well, I understand.
There's a lot of outrage over it.
I understand the idea. Well, it's like, you know, been burned once in this exact franchise with the PC version.
Invisible War.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I can understand feeling like, oh my God, it is being de-emphasized and sloughed off to a lesser place where we don't even have to deal with it. But it doesn't sound like that's the position that they're actually taking. So
I think the fear is, you know, it's another example, like people were concerned with Crysis 2. It's the consolefication of gaming. Like, that's the priority. No, this is a PC game. That's where it should mm-hmm. be. And now they're not even making it the focus.
I think that's the crux of the matter. Yeah, that's the part I wanted to get out there. Is like, the frustration is amongst people who are like, well, this is a PC franchise. Why can't you be developing the PC version as the core version and letting someone else do the PS3 and 360 versions?
I think in that article, too, he was talking about interface tweak, like slightly subtle little interface tweaks for the PC version. So
he does indeed talk about that in the larger interview. If you want to read the entire interview, we have a much larger interview that Zav conducted with him, and that's up on Shack News. You can get it. There's a lot of detailed information about the about the upcoming game from in Deus Ex then there. Sorry, I was distracted and thinking about this next one. You guys seen the Randy Pitchford video?
I haven't.
Okay, so we found out early Thursday morning that Duke Nukem Forever has been delayed because, I shit you not, this is at the top of the price release, Duke never comes early.
Nice! Too bad they couldn't have waited one more week and announced this on April 1st.
Yeah.
Because that would have been rad.
You know, I have to say that, like, the president of 2K, Christoph Hartmann, has probably waited all of his executive life to be able to say, in case you hadn't heard, Duke never comes early. I mean, I'm thinking, like, when he's sitting around the New York boardroom, he's probably thinking, you know what I always want to do? I want to say, my mascot never comes early. Yeah.
I guess, but it's no longer a joke with this franchise. There's no more ha-ha good times. It's like...
Really?
Really.
Well, because, while I'm poking fun at Christoph saying that, fucking Pitchford, the video is hilarious. I think it's funny. Jem Alexander, who used to work with Joystick and is now a community rep for Europe on Square Enix stuff, was like debating me with on Twitter. He thought it was dumb. I thought it was funny because the fact is with this game, like, how do you take any of it serious anymore? It's funny. And they're just moving to June. They're moving to June for obvious reasons. There's too many shooters out right now. There's like, they need to let some time for, what did you just list? Like, how many shooters did you just rattle off just a minute ago what you've been playing?
Yeah, I know. I agree. There are a lot of shooters, but this is not the franchise that you mess with the release date if you're actually putting it out. Don't anymore. It's stupid.
You played it.
Unfortunately.
I played it. Have you guys
it's
played
real.
It?
Yeah. It's yes. real. It's like,
real. But I mean, to Jeff's point, it's kind of like seeing somebody getting, you know, in a movie or a joke, you see somebody get kicked in the balls, and that's the joke. And
oh, then, my balls!
And then somebody comes in and kicks him again, and then a third person, and then pretty soon it's like, dude, quit kicking that guy in the balls. That's not funny.
Yeah.
You know, like,
actually, apparently Jeff thinks it is funny.
It's funny.
You want to go to Costco later? Or actually want to go to Starbucks? I want to go to that Starbucks. So anyway, I think it was funny. They come in and change the price or change the release date on it. And
it should change the price.
They should. Well, it should be. Well, we'll see. They haven't announced formal pricing on it, have they?
Duke never pays full price. Penis.
Never. I think it's funny. At the end of it, they even close the video with, like, come take the piss out of us at the website. I mean, they had fun with, I don't know. I think that,
no,
as a business
decision, if you have to do this, they handled it probably the best way you could.
As a business decision, it makes perfect sense to let a little more time pass and come in the middle of summer in June. Like, I think it makes perfect sense for release timing. And I think it's funny that now Gearbox gets to say, oh yeah, we delayed the game too. I think it's fucking hilarious. I don't know.
I guess they just found out that hell hasn't
frozen over quite yet, so they got wait a little longer.
Instead of May 3rd, Duke's return will now happen internationally on June 10th and June 14th in North America, which is ironic that you'll
allegedly
get, you'll get it outside of North America prior to its American home debut, since he's flying the American flag everywhere he can go. One game you'll never get to see is Gunloco. Last Friday, Square Enix officially announced that it had canned the Xbox 360 exclusive third-person sprint action shooter.
Oh, I guess I'll only have El Pollo Loco now. So few things I can get loco these days.
You were the first one to get on the loco jokes. Damn,
dude. Although Loco Moco is pretty tasty, I have to admit. Loco Moco is very tasty. You guys don't care, do you?
I mean,
the game was terrible.
Yeah, I mean,
I played it at TGS last year, and it was like the premise of the game was like there were all these convicts on some convict planet, and they were like fighting each other to see who could escape. So it was sort of Running Man-ish. And the deal was like you would run and do like one contextual button and be like, so that would be like the sprint part. And then you'd like sprint and do contextual stuff like power slide underneath pipes or like duck around or vault stuff, you know, like pommel vaulted and stuff like, and then you'd be firing. And it sort of like was going for a club vibe as well. But yeah,
like a lot of people gave EA credit for canceling NBA Elite, or what were they calling it? Because it wasn't up to snuff, and that's good for them. You know, if the game didn't work out, it's unfortunate for all the developers that put in their blood, sweat, and tears and time into the game, and they don't get to see its release. But cut the losses, you know.
Yep. And then finally, we have an interesting development, and I know you guys I know you guys listening are quick to poo-poo things as social games, but I think it's really interesting to see what might happen with the idea of the Naked Gun getting a rebirth. I mean, obviously, you're not going to do another movie of the Naked Gun without Leslie Nielsen. It's impossible. But the premise of it, Police Squad, is pretty funny. And the idea of adventure games, which have worked in a lot of other arenas, sounds like something like as people are trying to move forward social games to being more than just, you know, click, 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 click. Roulette wheels. I think it, like, the idea of adventure games sounds really cool. They're going to do voice work. They've got great characters to play with. And this guy I met, who I haven't become like close friends with yet, but he's a really cool guy. His name's Nick Creacher. He does a lot of game and screenwriter work here in Hollywood. Is in on this, and he's a funny, like, the stuff he's written before is good. I love what you said. He says, as a writer who grew up watching Police Squad and the Naked Gun films, I can't tell you what an incredible feeling it is to be able to put things in Frank Drebin's mouth. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
He gets it, obviously. Yeah. So if he gets that, and you could do Police Squad, and obviously they're thinking about like the Telltale episodic games, because they're building it on GameCentric's story box engine, and they even bring up, you know, how there's an opportunity to do episodic content and make it like an adventure game. It could be cool. I don't know. I mean, you guys open to the idea?
Yeah, it's interesting that a lot of these, you know, we got Jurassic Park, we got Back to the Future, we got a lot of these
Those aren't social games, but imagine if Jurassic Park Telltale game was a Facebook game.
Yeah.
That would be cool. I wouldn't be upset about it.
No.
No.
So, I don't know. And plus, it's Police Squad. I love that sort of slapstick humor. That's the Sam and Max.
Do you think,
or
no, here's the question.
Or Leisure Suit Larry or any of that stuff, and it just fits perfectly into those fun adventure games.
That's the question. Is that comedy going to work in an interactive environment where you don't get to control timing?
Well, okay, you know what? It's up to those guys. And on that front, they also have I have to make sure I get his name right. They have one of the writers and producers of two of the Naked Gun films, Robert Locash. So hopefully with that creative team, they'll be on top of it.
Is he straight out of Locash?
Yes. All right. You know what we get to do here at the end of the show. Weapons. Hope you guys are all ready. You have about 10 seconds while the music fires off to get ready for your finishing moves.
It's the weekend, and it's time for Finishing Moves.
Yeah. Jeff Mattis.
Yes.
You get to finish them first.
All right. I actually just have a question for folks. I'm wondering at this point, since 3DS is out Sunday, who's buying it primarily for a game or specific games, and who is buying it primarily for the tech and hoping for good games to come?
Interesting. Jeff Cannata, finisher.
Well, I was thinking about bringing up a game we didn't get to, which is the Ghostbusters slime downloadable game.
Very cool.
But I didn't like it. Oh. So that's not very fun.
Well,
so
I'm gonna have you can finish them.
Give a thought that I had while we were talking about the AR stuff with the 3DS, and we were talking about large scale, and basically those guys that I mentioned before proved that you just make a bigger card and you can make a bigger thing. Take this idea, Nintendo. How about at this year's E3, you plaster a wall at the LA Convention Center with a giant AR card, and we can all see huge things on our 3DSs when we walk down to the convention center. We can see a huge virtual something because you plastered one wall with a virtual question mark card. Do wow. it. Make it happen. It'll wow everybody, and I'll be happy.
I like it. Christian, finish him.
A plea to developers I may have mentioned briefly on here before as an original Southpaw gamer and shooters.
Yep.
Make it so I can, when I go in and customize the controls and make it Southpaw so that I can change the face buttons like A, B, X, Y, map those commands over to the D-pad. I taught myself traditional controls because for Gears of War, I couldn't play in Southpaw, and then you have to, you know, it's like it's crow hand as you try to hit A to do all the contextual stuff. My little brother never finished Gears and hasn't played Gears 2, and a lot of other experiences like that because he's a Southpaw gamer. And I don't think it's that difficult to make that swap from ABXY over to the D-pad, and I don't think it'd be that expensive or hard to do. And I'd appreciate, and I think other Southpaw gamers would appreciate seeing that in gaming.
If Quake Arena on Dreamcast could do it.
Exactly. Yeah, right?
Quake Arena on Dreamcast did a lot of things that go underappreciated. You know, mine's interesting in that for now the fifth ongoing week, Rift did not wind up on my computer. And I'm starting to think some interesting things about MMOs, and among them are maybe without us ever having to talk about it, MMOs have started to retreat into niche status. And how much could social gaming vis-a-vis Facebook and other social networks be a bigger threat to MMOs than $60 box games or anything else? Because so much of the reason that people enjoyed, I think, games like World of Warcraft and their ilk is that social interaction, all those sorts of interpersonal relations that aren't, you know, us face-to-face, but are interpersonal relations. And they're doing all those things now through Facebook games, and they're much more conducive to the sort of time constraints that we have, because I can go in and play 5 minutes of Farmville and still go and play Assassin's Creed or whatever else I want to on my own time. Mm-hmm. Just a thought. I wonder, could Facebook games be the real threat to MMOs? I'm sure Blizzard somewhere already thought this a lot, and they've got it all master planned.
12 steps ahead.
All right, there you go, folks. That's the big show for today. Thanks, huge, huge thanks to David Ruffin Jr. Go pick up his new CD, All My Life, at cdbaby.com/David Ruffin Jr. Thanks very much to Christian Spicer for coming on the show, as always.
Thank you. Always a treat. I read what you guys put on the Shack thread. I reply. I still can't reply on NeoGAF, but I love talking to the audience.
I can.
High five. You can add me on Facebook, All This Talk. It's facebook.com/Christian Spicer. Twitter.com/Spicer. I love engaging with the audience. That's what's fun about doing this type of show, and aside from hanging out with you, lovely.
And we've got you on a regular monthly schedule now, so.
Just like a woman.
Wow.
It was a joke. I have to do at least a couple of bad jokes so that I can read about myself on NeoGAF and feel horrible about myself. So.
Not funny. That guy's not funny. Oh my God, he's not funny.
He knows a lot about games, but he is not a stand-up comedian.
Jeff, of course, you can always catch up with at totallyradshow.com and catch the daily episodes of the show.
Anything we got a review of Sucker Punch coming up, I believe, on Monday.
Awesome. Can't wait to see that.
Of particular interest to video gamers, I would say.
Definitely.
And lots more.
What games coming up next week also? Do you know?
I think we're all doing Crysis 2, and we probably will be talking 3DS a little bit as well.
I expect to see some big fist explosions after Crysis 2, since you'll all be nanosuit powered.
Yeah, baby.
All right, that's it for everything else. Please go and check us out on shacknews.com. Join us in the comments. Go by the Facebook channel, or whatever we call it. I guess we call it a Facebook page, YouTube channel. And we have so many different things to like go. You can't miss us. We're like a giant bus filled with chicks in white suits handing out Nintendo 3DSs. You just can't get away from them. Anyway, thanks very much for joining us. That's your Weekend Confirmed. And until next week, we are Ghost. Oh.
The new me can't stop my shine. These haters try to stop me, can't stop my shine. These haters try to stop me, can't stop my shine. These haters try to stop me, can't stop my shine. Can't stop my shine. These haters try to stop me, can't stop my shine. These haters try to stop me, can't stop my shine. These haters try to stop me, can't stop my shine. Can't stop my shine. Stop me, but they don't get close, so they do it from a distance. Week in Confirmed is brought to you by Game Center, the must-have app for gamers. Game Center is filled with game information, the latest gaming news from ShackNews.com, and videos and screenshots for over 7,000 games. Game Center is free and available now for the iPhone, Android, and Palm mobile devices.